It's time for Mac Break Weekly. Andy Iannacos here. But surprise, surprise, Renee's got the day off. Adam Engst from tidbits.com and Mac developer Daniel Jokut join us to talk about the planet of the apps, the new Apple reality TV show, why special ops are dumping Android for iPhones, and the new song royalty rate proposal from Apple. Is it a final attempt to kill Spotify? It's all coming up next on Mac Break Weekly.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Mac Break Weekly is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Mac Break Weekly, episode 516, recorded Tuesday, July 19th, 2016. The Mac Flat Tax. Mac Break Weekly is brought to you by Audible.com. To download the free audiobook of your choice, go to audible.com/MacBreak. And by Adobe Marketing Cloud. Introducing audio white papers for marketing. White papers read aloud to keep you up to date with the latest trends in technology. Listen today by searching audio white papers for marketing on iTunes or visit Adobe.com for more information. And by Blue Apron. Blue Apron will send you fresh, high-quality ingredients to cook delicious meals with simple step-by-step instructions right to your door. See what's on the menu this week and get your first three meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/twit. That's blueapron.com/twit. It's time for Mac Break Weekly, the show where we cover the latest news from Apple with the wonderful Andy Iannacos from the Chicago Sun-Times. Hello, Andrew.
Hello, Leo. How lovely to see you today.
Hot New England.
Yeah, I just noticed that I'm very, very glowy. I might, maybe just for summer months, I might need to like get some foundation or some sort of powder because I look very glowy.
Adam Engst apparently is big on the sunscreen, on the other hand, because
I won the worst tan on the track and cross country teams 3 years running in high school.
Well, and I know you're a runner, so you really must slather up.
Yeah, well, this is what I look like, sunscreen. If I don't do the sunscreen, then I just look red.
It's a different story.
Very
fair. And wonderful journalist covering the Mac longer than anybody at tidbits.com, the longest-running Apple newsletter. And I'm really thrilled to get Daniel Jokut on this show. Am I saying your name right? I've never said it out loud.
It is perfect. You're saying it perfectly. And I'll remind you, Leo, you've said it out loud because I was just looking at the history books here and I've been on this show almost 8 years ago.
Oh, wow.
So it's great to be back.
Every 8 years, Daniel, whether you're ready or not, we're bringing you back.
I was just thinking
how amazing how long the show's been running. And it just.
We're in our 11th year now.
Oh, yeah.
Daniel is with Red Sweater Software. He's a software developer, one of the best. And one of the, I think, I always want to get you on the show whenever we have developer, you know, we talk about the App Store and things like that, because you're very outspoken, but you're also, I think, very fair. And you represent the developer community, the Mac developer community, quite well. Quite well.
Thank you. Well, I do try to.
Mars Edit, I use it all the time to write to, well, I used to when I. I guess Squarespace doesn't have an API, huh?
No, they don't. That's an unfortunate progression, in my opinion. But that's the choice they made, and it seems to be working okay for them.
Yeah. You can email. I do sometimes. And then, of course, they have their own interface. And they have their own software. But I loved using Mars Edit. It was the easiest way to post to WordPress ever.
Thank you.
Mars Edit and Acorn was, like, I thought, the kind of the perfect blogging platform. Also, Black Ink, I did not know about. Is this relatively new, or am I just behind?
Black Ink is pretty old by now. This actually, if you think back, you probably remember I acquired Mars Edit from Brent Simmons, who originally developed it. And it was around within a month or so of that, I had made this kind of like quip on my blog because I was offended by somebody who had sold somebody some software. I forget the details, but there was like a raw deal somebody got. And so I said, I'll buy somebody's software who wants to sell it for $5,000. And Black Ink is what came of that.
Oh, how funny.
So it was kind of like a wheeling and dealing thing. But I took this old app called Mac X Word and sort of gave it my my polishing up and try to turn it into the kind of Mac app that I thought it should be.
I'm glad I'm glad you're keeping it around, because I'm a crossword puzzle fanatic.
Oh, good. Yeah.
Yeah. And then, but before this, and I guess you don't do it anymore. You had a notebook program, right?
No, not a notebook program. You might be mixing me up with Gus Mueller of Acorn fame again.
Now, what did before you did these?
I have a couple other apps that I still keep around. One of them is called FlexTime.
Okay.
And I think you did use that, or you gave that a spin, because I tried to present that. I think that might be how we got to know each other,
because
I suggested it as something to help with your cue timing.
Right. That's right. That's right. Yes, I remember now. Yes. Okay.
And then I have an Apple Script utility called FastScript,
which I have used for years. Yeah.
Okay. And that's just kind of sits up in the menu bar.
Right.
And
Clarion.
That just about rounds it out.
And you miss Clarion.
Oh, Clarion, of course, Clarion. That's my oldest app up there. I think that app is probably 20 years old now.
What?
If not more.
What? Is this written for PowerPC?
It was originally written in Carbon. All in Carbon. So
nice. God, we've been the Mac's been around for a while. If Carbon is 20 years old, wow.
Right.
I think there are too few apps out today that have that brushed steel appearance.
Let's bring it back.
What was wrong with Aqua?
You don't put any of your apps on the app store, do you?
I actually do. Even though I'm pretty outspoken about the App Store, I try to be somewhat of a reasonable business person. So when the App Store came out for the Mac, I jumped on it, and I have to admit, it really did. It helped my sales a lot. So not everybody has had that experience, but in my case, at least when the App Store came out, it was not quite, but approaching like a doubling in sales.
Wow.
So that was very welcome. And it really seemed at that point, at least, to be bringing in customers who wouldn't have otherwise discovered the software. So there's a lot to talk about with the App Store as far as things that, you know, I wish were different. But I mean, at that time, at least, and you know, I keep my stuff in there to this day. The stuff that's qualified, you know, so something like FastScripts is funny. It's in there, but it would never be qualified to be in the App Store today. There's a sort of grandfathering in of stuff that is not sandboxed and can't be sandboxed. But you know, it's nice. I get now still a fair amount of sales through the App Store, and I keep my regular store open too, just to kind of have that flexibility to not put all my eggs in one basket.
Well, and one of the reasons you're here is because we've been having this conversation. Last week, of course, there was a lot of conversation about Apple and, you know, then their 30% and companies that didn't want to pay Apple the 30%, most notably, who was it? I can't remember.
Spotify. Yeah, right.
And, you know, we posited, but not being developers, didn't know, but we posited that it's one thing for a company like Spotify, which has almost no margin, actually negative margin, to hand over 30% to Apple. It's another thing for a software developer. And I think we, the clued-in reporters, thought that that was a pretty good deal for software. So, but I know you've also been, you know, critical of the App Store. So we thought we should get somebody who actually uses the App Store on.
30% is pretty high.
Is it too high? Yeah. Is it too high? I guess, Adam, you have some apps there too.
Well, not so much apps, but we deal with the iBook Store and do a lot of selling of take control books on our own and through various carts and services. And 30% is really high.
Yeah, but that's not the same as so. There's software, there's publications, books, subscriptions, and then there's, you know, music. Definitely, I could see why Spotify wouldn't want to do it, or maybe, you know, Amazon or Netflix. But I can also feel like if you're developing software, you get the bonus of people feel comfortable with it, and you don't have to put it in a box, you don't have to ship it to a store, you don't have a middleman. I mean, if you had...
I think it comes down to discoverability, that if you believe the App Store is going to provide you with more customers who you could not reach otherwise, then it's worth doing and it's worth taking that 30% hit. I mean, we'll give out 30% coupons to acquire a new customer pretty happily. But if you're selling to your own audience, you can drop that 30% to, you know, 3% or 5% so easily that it just doesn't make financial sense to have your primary work going through Apple if you can handle the rest of the store stuff on your own using someone like FastSpring or Accelerate or, you know, one of the Digital River companies.
It isn't like the days when you had to go to a distributor.
No one's doing physical sales anymore, basically, at all. You know, the number of people doing putting stuff in boxes. And I mean, remember the end caps? Remember the Mac Connection catalogs? I loved Mac Connection catalogs. And but yeah, those days are long, long gone.
So Daniel, you feel it's a good deal. But now it's interesting because you have experience on both ends because you also sell direct.
Well, and I think just to add to what Adam was saying, it's right in the middle of, I think, where people who are used to paying, you know, 3% credit card processing fees, and then you know whatever the nominal costs of having a website at all, they're likely to see it as not a great deal if you just look at the numbers alone. And then people who are used to putting software on CD-ROMs and putting them in boxes and then having distributors and maybe hopefully getting 40% of the final cut. I don't know. I don't even know what it would be.
I think 40 is probably right.
Well, and then it looks pretty great that you get to suddenly keep 70% through the App Store and get, have them take care of all the mechanics of it. But I think more and more, I think just what people are observing is you can't really compare it to the way things used to be, because obviously we're all enjoying all these efficiencies of the internet and the fact that we don't have the boxes, we don't have the CD-ROMs. So it's kind of a pointless comparison to compare it to a time when things just were more expensive to make and distribute. And I think what many developers, myself included, even if I think it's a fair deal, or not putting aside whether I think it's a fair deal, even if it's a deal I'm willing to be part of, you can still look at it and say, wait a minute, does Apple, the richest company in the world, really need to be taking 30%? I'd be really curious to know how much it actually costs them. They obviously give a lot to folks who, for example, are hosting like a gigabyte worth of data, per download. Maybe they're getting a better deal from Apple Store for that than somebody who's selling an app that happens to be 500K or something. But it just seems like most people can look at it and say, well, can Apple get by like charging 0%? No. Can they get by charging 10%? Probably. Can they do 20%? Seems like definitely. And so it just becomes a question of like, when will Apple sort of decide that on balance, it's better to support the community, to support the developers who are adding value to the platform. And if they can do like, say, 20%, without batting an eye, and it would help the developer community, why not do that just to sort of invest in their own developer base?
Giggling. I think the other side of it, when you look back at the way software was historically sold, aside from the fact that you have all of the, the distribution in CD-ROM and blah, 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 is that prices were also a lot higher. So, your software was $99, $149, the big stuff, $499. And for the most part, those software prices have also been driven through the floor. So that 30% is only part of the whole change that's come about as we've switched from a physical model to an electronic model. And, obviously, if that's in the Mac App Store, it's one thing. You can look at the iOS App Store and, the prices are, many apps are just free and going on in-app purchases. So it just changes a lot of the approach to how developers have to think. And it's not necessarily good or bad, but it is distinctly a sea change, and it's one that Apple forced on the world without anyone really having a choice.
And yet, Daniel, it sounds like you're not completely unhappy with it. If it doubles your sales, taking 30% is worth it.
Yeah, that's the experience that I had. So it did put me in a state of mind to be less complainant about it.
Right.
definitely. I think like a lot of developers, I just try not to think about the 30%.
Right. Thing. Just pretend. Do you consider charging 30% more, or does that not enter into your?
I would never. I would never do that because
I don't think they let you.
Well, they do.
Well, that's what Spotify does, though, remember.
Speaking of Spotify, right. They do. You know what? Early on, in the very early days, I think they had a rule that said you couldn't do that. And then I think it just became too blatantly clear that some business models like Spotify can't swallow the loss, right? If it's like a business where the prices of things and the cuts that other people get, and there's, you know, other people involved, that, you know, if the music that Spotify is paying for basically has to be paid for at $10 a month or whatever, then they can't suddenly be getting by with $7 a month. So,
well, it's certainly, and it's certainly great that, you know, you saw the doubling in sales. You know, from the Take Control side and the iBook Store, iBook Store is 4% of our sales. So, we don't leave the money on the sidewalk, but it's money on a sidewalk.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. That's interesting. So it doesn't help you much at all, in other words.
Yeah. I mean, we do it.
But then again, Adam and Tanya are a special case where they really have built up their own brand. You could almost say that they bring more prestige to the iBook Store than the iBook Store brings an audience to them.
I want you on my side. You should be talking.
Well, and that's actually a good point too, Andy, because as you and I and all of us probably on this call know that there have been a lot of people leaving the App Store, and a lot of them who have left have been people who I think brought with them prestige away from the App Store. You know, names that jump to mind like BB Edit, Sketch. There's a lot that Panic stuff. Mm-hmm. And you think these are like the people in the Mac world that are considered like the most successful, best examples of development on the platform. And then they're, you know, they're not forced per se to leave, but if they feel compelled to leave, I think that gets at the core of, you know, that there are problems with the App Store. And, you know, you're right, Leo, I'm not really complaining too loudly about the App Store, but it's been a frustration to me. And you know, things like sandboxing, which, you know, are just like new security requirements for software on the Mac. It's like things like that you can kind of get behind on the one hand, but be frustrated by the implementation on the other hand, and have to acknowledge that it's just slowed a lot of developers down or impeded developers from being able to even do things sometimes.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's not just the money either. Oftentimes it's a lot of the developers that I've spoken to who have specific problems with the App Store, it's not even so much the cut that they're taking so much as they're forced that to participate in the App Store means that they have to support certain APIs that Apple is introducing. And some of these APIs may have really nothing to do with what these creators feel is part of their vision for their software. But nonetheless, they're taking time and money away from putting in really important new features because they now have to support iCloud. And iCloud kicked so many butts of so many developers trying to get this thing to work when the thing really was not in any sort of a shape to deploy to begin with. And I think that's one of those little things that causes developers to have kind of a sour taste in their mouth about the App Store, where once again, it was a thing that they just wasted months and months and months of time on a feature that they didn't think was going to deliver any value to their customers, on something that really wasn't ready to deploy to begin with. So it's a complex problem. And as usual, with these things, you tend to run the engine at redline until it shakes apart. And then you look at the broken pieces and you say, okay, that thing is the thing we need to fix to make a successful version of this.
Mike, I guess my only qualm or concern would be if you couldn't still sell the software on your website. When they first announced the store, that was my greatest concern, is that Apple was at some point going to say, okay, and that's, as it is, by the way, on the iPhone, that's the only way you can do it.
Mm-hmm.
Had they done that, I would then say, well, there's no choice. But you can always put it on your website, as you do, as Rich Siegel does. So I think for some customers, it's not as desirable. I know Alex Lindsay says, I really try to buy everything on the App Store because it's so easy when I go to a new machine to just re-download all my apps. I get updates automatically. There are some real conveniences for end users.
Yeah, I mean, the App Store is such a great idea. And my argument from the beginning with, you know, well, at first it was, I thought, great. You know, for the whole first year of the App Store, there was no such thing as sandboxing. The Mac App Store, I mean, now. And so that was also another one of these kind of, you know, sort of a bait and switch things, because, you know, people got excited about the App Store, put their apps in, and then a year later, Apple's saying to some of them, your stuff's not really welcome here anymore. But from the beginning, I thought okay, let's take the sandboxing idea, making things more secure. Basically, the gist of sandboxing is requiring an app to accurately identify the types of privileges that it wants to have for your data and access to your network, printing, et cetera. I thought the best thing Apple could do would be to really embrace that, expand the list of things that you can ask for so that it actually covers all of the legitimate software uses on the platform. And, you know, make it so that it would be appealing to have all software in the Mac App Store, because customers don't want to have to think, is this a type of software that is suitable for the Mac App Store? They just want to think, how do I solve a problem? And if I could get it through the Mac App Store, I'll do that. And then right now, you know, you have this whole classes of software that you just can't be on the Mac App Store. One that comes to mind is Text Expander from Smile, right?
Yeah.
It's a beautiful app. And of course there are security implications of software that monitors all of your keystrokes. But, you know, people want the solution anyway. And if they could get that through the App Store, and if sandboxing had a way to say, hey, just so you know, we're fully admitting here that we're going to monitor keystrokes, but you had this sort of, you know, the same kind of like system for evaluating trust in a company by its reputation, by the number of users it's had over the years, by the fact that they haven't had any security, you know, issues that I know of. But Apple doesn't want to go there. They want to leave the Mac App Store as sort of only a certain class of software. And I think that just sort of breaks the whole system of, like you were saying, Alex Lindsay, celebrating, like you can go to a new computer and just have all your software show up. But it will never be the case if the Mac App Store can't accommodate all of the software you need.
Yeah, that's a good – well, and I don't know anybody that it does that for. No. But if I only have to download, you know, BB Edit and Mars Edit, and I can download everything else on it, you know, then
you're
going to
be migrating anyway. I guess I don't buy that as an argument. The fact is that you have so many settings, so many documents. When you go to a new computer, you want to do a migration.
I understand, but I'm just telling you, Alex says it, and I kind of agree with him. It sure makes it easier. It's just one less thing you have to worry about.
I switch to a new computer once every 3 to 5 years.
That's the difference. We are in a position of using new computers more than once a year. So, yeah. Well, anyway, I'm thrilled to have you, Daniel, and everybody should go to red-sweater.com and buy their stuff there, right? You would say that, right?
Well, you know, I'm still to this day, I'm conflicted, because even though I like keeping that extra 30%, there are advantages to selling through the App Store. You get every sale you make through the App Store ups your ranking in sort of the stats, and that's sort of a self-perpetuating thing. If you get up in the ranks, then
that's right. Same with podcasts, right? Yeah,
right. It's the same story. And so I'm really never. People ask me like, "What do you want me to do?" And they're trying to be such a great customer and say, "You know, how can I do that?" And I have to just say, I really don't know. So do whatever makes you happy. Like I do like the idea of paying me. But how you do it, I'm really not sure what the right choice is. And I'm just thrilled whenever I make a sale. So if you want to buy something, buy it anywhere you can find. That's, you know, just don't pay those pirates online who pretend to be software sales.
Right. I think the really big part that gets us actually is that when you buy from the Mac App Store or the App Store or the iBook Store or whatever, you are Apple's customer, not the developer or the publisher's customer.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So I can't easily give you free updates. I can't communicate with you in any way. If it's an app, I can't support you because I don't know who you are. And so that's the kind of thing that would just be, it would be nice if Apple built some kind of direct connection in so that you felt like those people were your customer.
Totally agreed. But it's, you know, it goes both ways too, of course, because there are some types of software you just want to download as a customer, the same way you would buy the software in a box at the store a long time ago, and maybe some of us wouldn't fill out the card and fill in.
I never fill out.
But so there's some companies you want a relationship with, and some companies you probably don't. And I do agree, though, Adam, it would be nice if Apple gave us some.
Yeah.
You know, they went in this direction with the music store, of all things, when they say, you know, here, connect with your favorite artists.
Yeah.
But they don't want you connecting with your favorite developers, I guess.
We're not as pretty.
If you follow somebody on Apple Music, do they get any information about you? Probably not. Apple's never going to give anybody your name and email address.
Probably not. No. So the best we could hope for, I think, are little changes like the ability for developers to respond to reviews, for example, would be nice. You know, just let the let the giant, like, you know, critical review stand as it is, and then have a little response from the developer underneath that says, hey, this is my impression of this.
They do that on the Android store, and I, by the way, I cannot tell you how helpful that is for an end user. I'm sure what a relief it is to developers. It really, if I'm looking at reviews and I see critical reviews with no rebuttal, I don't know what to think of it. But when the developer says, oh, you, they don't say this, but in effect, you idiot, it's not supposed to work on a Android phone
that's
or whatever.
Someone else's app.
Yeah, it's not my, whatever. Those things are very useful, and I see them all the time now in the Android store. And by the way, when I see responses, even to negative reviews, I think, well, at least it's an engaged developer, and that's really all you can hope for. That's what you want. So the fact that you're not, you can't do that, just that makes me mad.
Yeah, there's lots of little things. That's the thing is, you start going down this down these lists of developer wishes, and for that matter, customer wishes, and you start off with one or two, and they don't sound like a big deal, but then as you start to realize just how many there are, and I can't even wrap my head around it, you know, usually in one sitting, it's like, oh, right. And then that's another thing we can't do. And that's another problem we have. That's another obstacle. It really adds up.
I am, and I know I'm a way outlier, but I am giving up on commercial operating systems, period. I don't want to use Windows or Mac anymore. It hurts me a little bit to leave the Mac platform. It's the only thing I have used. I gave up on Windows long ago. But now I'm actually retiring my 5K iMac. Won't retire fully. It'll come here and be used. But at home for a free BSD box. And at the same time as I'm doing that, by the way, I'm also retiring Google Cloud Storage for a self-hosted cloud solution that I'm hopeful will be more secure and more private. And I'm not a huge privacy advocate, but I'm tired of companies not considering users' needs as paramount. Developers are important. You should probably consider them too, because to the extent developers are happy, users are happy. But when you ignore developers and users, I don't think that company should get my dollar.
Yeah, I think that so long as you're leaving people with options, so long as you're giving them, like, for instance, it's the difference between the way that the Mac App Store operates and the iOS App Store operates. The Mac App Store, you can have the comfort and the convenience of buying things through a central repo. But if there are things that are kind of off the grid, that either the developer doesn't want to have to deal with App Store restrictions, or it frankly is the type of app that Apple does not approve of, Apple doesn't have to approve of every app that's on your computer. You can absolutely defeat that gatekeeper and use it that way. The problem is that I think that when you have something like iOS, where you have no option but to get stuff through this one store, and when developers have a situation where we have no option but to conform to whatever rule that Apple wants to impose upon us to allow us to have access to this platform, I don't think that it's a particularly evil thing for Apple to do. I think that it's in Apple's best interest, but it's also in the consumer's best interest. But I don't think it's ideal. Every time that someone like me complains about, but what about the consumer who wants this, or what about the user who needs this to happen? If the way to shut me up is to say, well, they can do that. They just they can't do it as easily as they could with this thing that we're trying to encourage them to do. But yes, if they want to go into settings and then click through eight barriers and then open a locked file cabinet with a behind a sign saying "Beware of the leopard," we're willing to let them do this thing we don't want them to do because those people are motivated to do things that we think are harmful. But that's how to shut me up, and that's how I like to be shut up.
and Apple does things like it bans a surprising range of apps from the iOS App Store, political apps, for instance.
One thing I will say, Leo, though, I do think that it's actually interesting and important to separate operating systems from apps. And one of the things when people start complaining about, oh, Apple keeps updating OS X, now Mac OS, why should I upgrade, all that, blah, blah, blah. My answer is usually, what do you care? You use apps. The operating system exists to make allow those apps to run. And usually when you go from one operating system to the next, there's not significant compatibility issues for apps that are current and have been kept up. And so I find usually going to a new operating system is fairly minimal, or maintaining the same one. You know, I can still use BBEdit and Nicest Writer Pro and Panorama and Google Chrome and, you know, whatever the heck I want, all stuff that doesn't actually come from Apple. It's stuff that I'm layering on top to get the functionality I need. And so operating systems to me are relatively unimportant to the extent that they give me the capabilities.
Precisely. To the extent they get out of the way.
Right. Precisely. And that's
but increasingly, look at what happened with Windows. They're getting in the way. And then I think they're not serving the role they need to serve.
Yeah. Foundation.
And that's why I have no choice but to go to open source software, which is created by users for users.
Yeah, and that's fine too. But I think that anybody who goes to an open source operating system does so with a informed consent. They understand that they're going to be giving up a lot of.
Most people aren't going to do that. And
you have a note from your mother, Leo.
Yeah, I know what I'm doing. By the way, and I realize I'm actually kind of excited about it. And I realize it's my new game that for me,
absolutely,
this is like, it's like getting the new Call of Duty. Oh, free ASD. And I'm reading the ZFS tutorials. And, you know, for me, this is fun. And I realize for most people, not only is it not fun, it's horrible. And so
my son likes to install Ubuntu on his Chromebook.
Yeah. For some of us, that's a grand thing to do.
I was actually thinking about this with a problem that I had to solve that I won't get into the details of, but I was so pleased that to solve this problem on this device that ran Linux, it's a consumer box, the developers, probably because they didn't have the resources to do a really good like Google style or Apple style solution, simply said that the process to do the thing that you want to do is going to have it's going to be a big pain in the butt, but it's going to be a set of linear steps that are absolutely going to work. And I kind of like the fact that everything I needed to figure out what the solution was right there in the menus of this device. And I could figure out the best way for me to attack the problem and solve it. And now it's working perfectly. It's working great. And as I finished getting this thing up and running, it occurred to me that what if this were an Apple device or a piece of Google software where it simply said to set up, just plug it in and just wait for that red light to turn green. And well, what if it doesn't turn green? After it turns green, you're ready to go. So what do I do? Well, if it doesn't turn green, unplug it, plug it in again. I tried that. Didn't work. You're welcome. Be sure to send me that warranty card. You know, where it's where the software would have been set up to say, we don't want to trust that anybody will be able to figure out the sequence of steps that needs to be done to make this happen, even if the individual steps are very, very easy. So we're going to automate that process through a system that's going to be so complicated that it could fail at several steps, but we're not going to expose those steps to the user and therefore give him or her the ability to fix it themselves. And that's that's part of the satisfaction of an open source piece of software. Maybe the ideal world is that it just works without having to fiddle with it or having to trust something automatically happening.
Fascinating conversation. I didn't actually intend to get so philosophical, but I'm glad we did.
Do we introduce Adam? Because we've introduced.
Yeah, no, we got it.
And thank you, Adam Engst from Tidbits, for joining us today. Yeah. No, we're going to take a break. When we come back, there is a lot of Mac news. Some of it relevant to the conversation we've just been having, including a new TV show that has the best name ever. I mean, really, they almost had to do it, right?
Yeah, right.
but first, a word from Audible.com. Everybody knows we love, at least I shouldn't say we, I and Andy love audio books. I won't speak for Adam or Daniel. Audiobooks are great for people who commute, great for people who work out, people who do anything, walking the dog, running. Maybe Adam listens to some audio books while running. Mm-hmm. If you can't hold a book, but you still want to read. And what I found is my life got more and more busy is I just didn't have the reading time I wanted. And by the time I got in bed, my normal reading time, and opened the book, one page, so I wasn't getting much reading done for quite a while. That's when I discovered Audible. And this is now back in the year 2000. I was commuting, and I had two to four hours a day in the car. That meant 2 to 4 hours a day of reading. Man, have I been enjoying it. I've been loving it. I want you to try Audible. We're going to get you a book for free. Audible is without peer. It is the audio bookstore, 250,000 titles. And maybe even more importantly, All the new books come out on Audible now. It used to be that, you know, it was a hit or miss whether you get an audio version of a book. Pretty much every book now comes out on Audible so that you can pretty much be sure that the best sellers are out. They also go back in time, and I love this. Audible created a few years ago the Audible Frontiers program to take classic science fiction that never was released as an audiobook and re-release it on audio. Heinlein and Asimov and Frank Herbert's. And, man, if you haven't heard Dune, nobody has ever been able to make a good Dune movie. I guess I'd get argument on that. But because it's so expansive and so rich and be so difficult to put in on film. But when you're listening to Dune in your mind, it is every bit as expansive and magical and vibrant. And you are there with the Kwisa Haderach. And you're participating. And there's no weird Kyle MacLachlan to get in your way. It's there. You're in Dune. And I love that. In fact, at this point, I don't go see a movie unless I've listened to the book first at Audible. You can get your free book right now, audible.com/MacBreak. You'll be signing up for the gold account. That's a book a month. Your first month is free. So that first book is free. It's yours to keep, by the way. You cancel any time in the first 30 days and pay nothing. You'll also get the Daily Digest of the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal. I should ask Andy what he's listening to on Audible, because half of the books I listen to are yours, maybe more. I just finished that Patton Oswalt book that you recommended. I loved that.
Oh, God, that was superlative. Silver Screen. Almost everything he writes.
Yeah, he's great.
Yeah. I'm trying to backfill like authors that I was both forced to read as a kid and didn't like because I was being forced to read them. So I'm sort of seeking out other things.
Yeah. Silas Marner never sounded so good. That should be their slogan.
Exactly. If you can get me to enjoy Ethan Frome, that'll be hasn't happened yet, but I believe that you could find the right audible.com like book reader to find that I'm saying, okay, fine. I do find the imagery of the color of the candy dish really.
Actually, you know what's really good on Audible? Moby Dick, which is a great book. But the Audible version you're there on the deck. It's the Pequod.
Which version do you have? Is it like almost like a staged reading? Is it multiple voices or just one person reading?
No, it's just one person. They have a staged reading now?
I don't know. I can imagine.
That's one of the things they do that I love. Yeah.
Oftentimes, like Neil Gaiman's work, they did a staged reading of American Gods, where they basically cast every single role. So it really is like you're in a theater with like 18 actors behind microphones with script books.
One of my favorite books. I love that. You're right. Yeah.
Yeah. But I'm saving for some reason. I have never read Moby Dick. I am saving it for. I feel like I have to read it in the original text. And I
this
don't
is the,
know
this
why
is the
I
version
read
I read. Frank Muller, who I is one, I really love his narration. This is the one I read. It's from Recorded Books, but
when you get a book like that, where yes, maybe you were forced to read it in school, but it's like almost a 200-year-old book, and people are still claiming that it is one of the greatest novels ever written. Not just for it's a little bit dry. It's not really relevant today. But if you understand the importance of this book, Moby Dick is like it's still one of the most gripping and chilling books. Yep. That's why I probably actually I probably have three copies of it, both like in the live library and in the book depository in my storage unit, because when I go to a used bookstore, it's like, oh, maybe it's because I don't have it in this really nice cloth binding. I'll buy this used copy, and that'll be the copy that I finally read. Recommendation. I'm reading Cat's Cradle by Kurt Vonnegut.
Oh, love that book.
I've only read Breakfast of Champions so far. And it was one of those things where I got a deal on this book someplace else. And then as it happens, you just don't want to. You have to put the book down because you have to go wash dishes or you have to go work on your email. But if you have the Audible version of it, then you can keep reading it as you're doing all this drudgery work. And you don't have to leave the world of that book. It's good for long. Actually, maybe that would be the best way to do Moby Dick. Just basically have four or five days of my life where I'm doing nothing but every waking and free time moment reading or listening to Moby Dick.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think Kurt Vonnegut is a good choice. So Slaughterhouse-Five is a wonderful audiobook. I've read that on Audible. Anyway, now we're just making it hard for you to choose. audible.com/MacBreak. Your first book is awaiting you and a lifetime of great listening. I've now been a member for 16 years. That's kind of amazing. Love Audible. Let's move on. We have a great panel here. Not only Andy Iannacco, but also from Red Sweater Software, Daniel Jalkut. And from Tidbits, one of the longest running Mac newsletter, free at tidbits.com, Mr. Adam Engst. It's the planet of the apps. On the one hand, what a great name. And Apple's going to produce this. But on the other hand, I'm a little disappointed that they really are going with just a straight-ahead reality show format. It feels like that's not as innovative as it could be.
Yeah, especially when you look at how reality shows are produced, where they don't really are shaped by producers, or at least the understanding when you're watching them is that they didn't just simply pick, like, if this is supposed to highlight the development of apps, they didn't pick like the five most promising apps. They decided they wanted to cast a role of, here is the socially demented nerd, is the team that works well together, here is the husband and wife whose marriages might come apart as nerves are frazzled. Here's the 12-year-old wonder genius, and you know that, like, if this were America's Got Talent, you're like, it doesn't matter who they show in the next 11 weeks. You know that they pick the adorable 12-year-old girl who cries every time a judge says something nice about her singing. They know that they picked her to win.
Love reality shows. I mean, the ratings are great. People love American Idol and The Voice and Survivor and on and on and on. Naked Dating or whatever it's called. But by the way, they may be naked, but you don't get to see it. I don't understand. What's the point? Okay. No, I'm kidding.
The point is scabs. You get to see scabs in all kinds of places, except for just two or three.
So I guess this is going to be kind of like, I don't know, Shark Tank or Project Greenlight, where you've got 10 app developers and they try to convince the, you know, big shots that they've got the next big app, and then blah, blah, blah. Applicants must agree to have their app functional on iOS, macOS, tvOS, or watchOS by late October. If they're accepted onto the show, developers will receive guidance from tech experts. Potential fund...
They need to be in front of all of us.
Funding from VCs of up to $10 million in promotion in Apple's iOS store. So there's an open casting call. It will be filming later this year. Daniel, are you gonna try out?
I wanted to be the Tim Gunn of this show. I thought that would be more appropriate.
Yeah,
we want to be judges.
I have nothing against reality shows, but I just feel like as you say, Andy, it's going to be archetypes, but it's also inevitably going to be misrepresenting the real process.
Of course.
Yeah.
Especially because, I mean, what have we been talking about for this whole first segment of the show? Frustrations with the App Store, we haven't gotten into frustrations with submissions and app rejections. But this defines what it means to be a developer on Apple platforms in many ways these days. Yeah. And even apart from that, like, if Apple's paying for the show, you're not either going to even have things like frustrations with, like, the inscrutability of an API.
You'll never hear about that.
all the kind of stuff that might make for natural drama in a show that's, like, about something that's kind of hard to jazz up, I think, you know, software development.
But the natural drama would be dealing
with problems that Apple doesn't really want to put the spotlight on. So,
no, and that's my concern. This is really just going to be a great big ad for Apple. And how great it is, and oh my God, you've won the jackpot, you're going to be the next WhatsApp, and that's really, I think, not the message that should be, that kids especially who are thinking of this as a career should be.
I had an idea for Apple's, why would Apple choose to do this show of all shows? And Apple is sort of like so many tech companies, just famously troubled by recruiting, right? Trying to find employees.
This is how you find talent.
They're going to have a roster of ambitious, probably not all of them talented, but they're going to have a pretty good dossier here of people who are willing to really, I guess, fight for being a developer, fight for building great apps. And then Apple being the one in charge of all this, I guess they can just come swoop in and say, hey, regardless of whether you got on the show or whether you won the show, how'd you like to come interview for this position? So,
oh, you—that's a really good point, Daniel. That may be the real reward.
I mean,
a job at Apple.
Yeah.
Forget that.
I don't know. I mean, how much trouble are they having attracting talent as it is?
Daniel, by the way, we didn't mention this, but you were an Apple. You worked at Apple. You were a developer at Apple.
I was, yeah, starting in 1995 through 2002. So I've been out of Apple for much longer than I ever worked there. But I do have some experience with the company. And, of course, it's fueled my interest over the last.
Yeah, and you were there at the rebirth. What did you work on?
I worked on System 7, System 8. And then I jumped ship from the System 7 team and went to work on very early OS 10 stuff.
Wow.
And the stuff I was working on was always really low-level stuff, usually stuff with no graphics interface, you know. So stuff on System 7, I worked on stuff like the Process Manager. And then I switched over to OS 10 and worked on stuff like the Code Fragment Manager, which was the the thing that loads the code literally from disk to make an app run. So it was real low level, you know, real nerdy stuff. But yeah, it was an experience. And to be there at that time, I was hired. I was actually hired as a full-time employee in 1996, a few months before Steve Jobs came back.
Wow.
So it was really quite a time to be there. And, you know, people talk about it a lot these days. But that was the time when, wow, the folks who were at Apple then and stuck around, that was like a time to really believe in the company, because everybody was leaving to go to companies that, you know, conventional wisdom would say had a shot in the world. And and Apple was at the bottom of that list for almost everybody, including many people, you know, many of us who were in the company, I think, still thought it was a long shot, but we couldn't find anything better to work on. So it was exciting to be there. And I'm really proud of Apple for, you know, making it as far back as they have. And my only complaint is that they're so powerful that, you know, I certainly have no ability to rein in that power. So see how far they go, I guess.
Eddie Q gave a interview to the Hollywood Reporter. You know, at first I thought, oh, this is great, let's see what Eddie says, but it really was. It wasn't what I'd call a hard-hitting interview. It was basically Eddie making his pitch to Hollywood, right? Remember, he's talking to Hollywood for why Apple is going to be the next big creator. They did ask him about Planet of the Apps. They also asked him about Dr. Dre's reputed TV show, and he denied knowledge of it. He said, I think Dre's filming something. given Eddie's job, I think he probably knows more than that.
The bit about the skinny bundle, what was interesting, though.
Yeah. So
he didn't want to. I mean, basically, he was saying that Apple wasn't a big fan of the skinny bundle where you get to pick and choose what you want. He was claiming that people are mostly just frustrated by how hard it is to deal with the fat bundles.
Yeah. So when I read that, I thought, he knows who he's talking to. and he's reassuring them, don't worry, we're not going to do it to you what we did to the music industry. Because, of course, what was Apple's big change to the music industry? The 99-cent single, the elimination, in effect, of the album format, the skinny bundle of music.
Yeah.
And he said, so I think whether it's true or not, I think it's a message, right? Don't worry, we're not going to disintermediate. He says, if Time Warner or DirecTV wants to offer a bundle themselves, they should do it through Apple TV and iPad and iPhone. In other words, we'll just be the middleman. Whatever you want.
Take our 30%. Sorry.
Yeah.
I still don't understand the pitch that they would make to cable companies or even individual cable channels that would not make them just another player among many. Anything that would give Apple a distinct advantage over anything else.
Apple's ambition is not to be a better Roku, I don't think. I would hope.
Right? That'd be a tall order for them to actually do.
They may not even be able to do it. Okay.
Well. Yeah, I can't think of anything that I'm getting on my latest generation Apple TV that I can't get on other boxes, including the Roku. And it's not because of Apple's not doing their job or the technology's fallen behind, but because a company like Sling, what's in it for them to create an app or create a service that works on Apple TV but does not work on competing services? And I think that Apple's whole business plan is let's make stuff that is an exclusive Apple experience and not necessarily lock people into the platform, but essentially give them the advantages of one overseer overseeing the hardware, the operating systems, and the app platform all at once. So this is not me saying that this doesn't make sense, merely that I don't immediately understand what they could say to HBO or another company saying that this is why you should give us an advantage that you're not going to give to other people.
But what would we like Apple to do? I mean, where's the real opportunity? If you ask me, and we've been begging Apple to do this all along, they're starting to move in that way. And music is to disintermediate artists and creators and to become a direct conduit, just as they are for you, Daniel, of your apps to Apple customers, to be a distributor of music and television and movies direct to the audience.
Right. Can you imagine if Mars Edit, Acorn, you had to go through Warner Brothers or something to get, and we take that for granted now. Maybe it is, starting with stuff like Planet of the Apps. Maybe that's right. the first step towards that.
The way you start, of course, is by going down to Hollywood and saying, don't worry, we're not going to do that.
Well, exactly. And it's funny when you were talking about Eddie Q's comments, it's like what usually precedes Apple doing something
right.
big?
He's taking the Steve Jobs role.
Right.
Denial. Like,
nobody wants that.
Absolutely nobody
Skinny
wants
bundle,
it.
No.
Well, also, if pursuing that line, you could also say that the Planet of the Apps is sort of like the Motorola rocker content business, saying that we don't intend for this to be a success in any way, shape, or form. We just want to kick a rock down the hill, see where it bounces, so that when we kick our own rock, it makes it to the bottom safely.
On the note of the Planet of the Apps, I've also heard a lot of things. I'm sure you all have as well about Apple sort of like semi-secretly or completely secretly funding some of these music videos that have come out.
Taylor Swift and who was that guy? I don't even remember his name, but some rapper, right?
Drake. I think there was one of the Drake. Yeah. I think there was a rumor that Hotline Bling was...
Hotline Bling, right.
Is that Drake? I don't know. I'm not really up on this stuff.
But, I'm not either, but the kids
tell me. But, you know, if that's... that's music, obviously. That's different, sort of inherently different, I think, from fully produced television programs and such. But I guess if you've got a team that knows how to make television shows and Apple offers you a bunch of money, why wouldn't you consider that, right?
But Eddie says, this is, again, remember who he's talking to. We are only going into the content business with projects we think are really tied to our products. Right now, that's Apple Music. The rest of it is about giving talent a platform that allows them to be creative in new ways. If I was an agent, I would be very, very excited about what Apple is doing because it lets the people that I represent be able to do more.
So if an agent came to you with a show package with a big star, would you take it?
Oh, no, probably not right now. We're not in the business of trying to create TV shows. If we see it being complementary to the things we're doing at Apple Music, or if we see it being something that's innovative on our platform, we may help them and guide them and make suggestions. But we're not trying to compete with Netflix or Comcast. Heaven forfend.
I'm sorry, that was a dramatization.
I thought you had Eddie on the show.
He does not sound like that. I'm sorry.
an audible, your own audiobook of the interview.
The Eddie Q story, yeah.
But it does like indicate that they have at least they're starting to learn the culture of entertainment, saying that we just if there's a way that we can enhance your product, we have a few notes. They're just notes. Just notes.
Take them or leave them.
In a way, it's more telling that they deny it. It is really that thing of, we wouldn't do that, is almost saying, we're going to do that.
Yeah, right.
We're thinking about it, right?
Or at least what purpose, or at least the Eddie Q and Apple has some purpose for making that statement. And that's, I don't think they do a lot of things by random or, by accident, I should say.
And it's accident that Eddie Q is spending, what does he say, he goes to Hollywood five times a month or something? I mean, which is a strange number. I'm trying to figure out, does that mean twice in 1 week and then once a week the other weeks?
Well, what's the basketball schedule?
Oh, he's going, you know what? That's right. He's a big Warriors fan, isn't he?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that's right. We saw him during the playoffs down there on the floor.
Repeatedly. The cover of everything.
Repeatedly.
But it's... You look at it, well, Amazon's tried to do something like this with Amazon Studios, but how many?
Netflix.
Yeah, I mean, well, Netflix is different. They were an entertainment portal to begin with. It was a really natural thing for them to do, and also weren't they kind of like the first ones to come up with this idea of, well, what if we were to offer not quite as much money as CBS, maybe not even quite as much money as HBO, but we will give you a good amount of money and. We're asking for 8 episodes, and then just we will expect it be delivered by FedEx on flash drive on this date, and that's the last time you'll see with us. The last time you'll see anything written from us is our name on a check. It would be interesting if they could do something along the lines of Louis C.K. when he did his last series, he did it direct to his fans, like through his email list, and if. They created a system by, as a result, a lot of people didn't know anything about this new series. I can't even remember the name of it. I've just heard people writing and talking about it. If they could do something like that, where they said, Louis, we'll take 30%, but we will distribute it. We will let it be promoted with social media. We will occasionally put it in an editor's picks. You don't have to worry about distribution. You don't have to pay for anything other than just creating it and then just giving us mastered files and it'll do it. It's interesting. I like I said, most of the when I talk about this, it's I just don't understand how this could work. But that's usually how innovation happens, when you create something that is so new that no one could have seen it. But as soon as you show it in front of them, they say, oh, this seemed inevitable, like the iPhone.
Yeah. Apple always likes to do the inevitable. It's never inevitable till Apple does it. I love the Register, and I love their take on stuff. Kieran McCarthy says, headline, McCain, come to my encryption hearing, Tim. Cook, no, I'm good. McCain, I hate you, I hate you, I hate you. Clearly that's not the verbatim transcript of the conversation. John McCain invited Tim Cook to attend a Senate hearing on encryption, the Committee on Armed Services hearing on cybersecurity last week. McCain went out of his way to note that Cook has declined the senator's invitation to give testimony alongside three opponents of end-to-end encryption on the company's iPhone. I must note for the record that these were not our only invited guests, McCain said. The committee extended an invitation to Apple CEO Tim Cook. He declined. I hope we'll reconsider in the future so this committee can benefit from the widest possible variety of perspectives. That doesn't sound like, I hate you, I hate you, I hate you, to be fair. The fact that none of the people he really wanted to talk about, you know, why, I wish Tim Cook had gone or sent a proxy, because I think it's important to educate these guys on why we need end-to-end encryption and why it's impossible to stop it. But they continue to have hearings.
Mm. Well, also, McCain's been saying some kind of harsh stuff. He's up for re-election, I think, this year, isn't he?
Yeah.
And probably. So he's been saying a lot of things that I think that Tim Cook may not be very, very happy about. So, but I don't know if that would preclude
but
him.
You still,
actually,
that's why you go
sending a representative.
Yeah. That's, well, or you don't go yourself, but that's why you send.
If you don't feel like anything productive to Apple is going to happen, or anything's productive to the world in general is going to happen, you don't go just to get the free pen.
Well, it's also the third rail, because it's best at this point for Apple just to shut up about this stuff, right? Because on the one hand, they can be forced. It doesn't, you know.
I think Apple picks its battles.
Yeah.
And this is not currently one of them that they wish to be playing in. They want to make sure that when they're pulling out the big guns, that they're actually doing it in a place that it matters, not at a time when, you know, it's going to be Tim Cook with three guys shouting at him.
I think they got as much as they needed and wanted from the San Bernardino court case, they demonstrated to the public that they want privacy and that they care, and we're the privacy company, we're the security company. Yeah. Anything more they say will not be beneficial, particularly since what could happen is the public could understand that that it's not up to Apple. And then, in fact, Apple isn't necessarily protecting their privacy, things like that. That's the kind of conversation you don't want to have. I think it would be smart for Tim to get up with his winnings and walk away from the table, and I think that's what's happening. I don't think it's a snit fit. He's a smart guy. Unlike Steve. I mean, you could Steve would say, you know, would have a snit fit. But I think Tim does not. I think Tim is very measured, cautious, and smart. And I think he says, no, we're good. Exactly right. We're good. We're good. We're exactly where we want to be on this. And their further conversation is not going to help, as you said, Andy, going to help our business.
Yeah. Also wonder how much the fact that this is an election year could affect things, not just for the Senate race, but also the presidential race, because you could I think we're all kind of relieved that treating encryption as a tool for terrorism and for no other purpose. I feel as though that's been floated as a trial balloon by a lot of people. As is this something that can really get people scared? And if so, can we scare people into voting for our person based on this? And that's why we haven't seen this. It went up and then went down, and no one really cared about it. Maybe part of the decision making is also, is this going to be a thing where, well, you know, I brought Apple right into this conference room, and I told him that you just can't talk to these people. That's why you need to put me in the Senate. That's why you need to put me in the governorship, because only people like me can protect you from
I think the encryption debate is a little too complex for a campaign that it's just one of those things. It's hard to
not as simple as international terrorism.
I think you can make
you dumb it down to you are in danger right now. I'm going to protect you from danger by fighting those people. I saw a flashlight commercial, a commercial for a cheap Chinese made flashlight that said, okay, well, if it runs in the rain, that's great, and if you can drop it, and that's fine. And said, oh, it also has this. If burglars try to attack your family, it has this special strobe light mode that'll scare them off. You don't want your people to your family be attacked by burglars without this special flashlight, do you? I'm like, it's a flashlight. Is this how easily you think we can be controlled by fear that we have a magic flashlight that scares off bad guys? Like, oh god. So yes, I do believe that they could dumb it down to the purpose of being, this is the weapon that ISIS wants to use against you. I don't want ISIS to have this tool, but the person I'm running against, he wants or she wants you to have. Wants ISIS to have this tool. Okay,
fine. We just need that John Oliver interview with Edward Snowden, where he gets Snowden to go through all the different NSA programs, which were designed to get a look at your pics.
We're going to take a break. Adam Engst from Tidbits is here. Tidbits.com. Great to have you and your giant penguin.
I never go anywhere without my giant penguin.
Yeah. By the way, that is not a Linux penguin, so don't get your panties in a bunch. Right? It's just a penguin.
This penguin doesn't predate Linux, but it is indeed unrelated.
It's not a tux. Actually, now that I notice, you have three penguins in view at least. Are you a penguin fanatic?
I can see at least five.
What?
Six?
What? Oh, four? And holy cow.
Wait, you can't see the poster behind me?
No, I see five. I see. Is that light switch a penguin?
Light switches are penguins.
Holy camoli. This is a good game we could play. I spy with my little eye a flightless bird.
So the poster on the door behind me is this photographer who's taken, I think Andy's done some stuff like this with cows, where he took some plastic penguins around the world and took pictures of them all over the place. And he published a book of this. It's a wonderful, wonderful poster.
I'm just going to start calling you Mr. Popper. Are you?
I have a copy of that too.
Maybe we talked about this. You're kind of a penguin
I've liked penguins since I was four. I have my first penguin from the New York Aquarium when I was four.
Have you ever smelled penguins?
Yes.
They're not the most...
Well, have you smelled a chicken house?
No, a chicken house is worse. A chicken house is worse. But I remember going, where was I? We were in South America and going to a penguin colony.
I visited penguins in Tasmania.
Oh, neat. Yeah.
On the Bruny Islands off the coast of Tasmania. So, you know, Australia is an island off the coast of Asia. Tasmania is an island off the coast of Australia. The Bruny Islands are islands off the coast of Tasmania.
It's islands all the way down.
It's 1,500 miles to Antarctica.
Wow. You
know, there's nothing left.
Wow.
And but that's where the little blue penguins come to nest.
Oh, neat.
And we went there in 1998 and enjoyed it immensely.
I really did enjoy seeing the penguins, actually. That was really cool. And I want to see more penguins. Those are emperors behind you, right?
Yeah. The one behind me is from Emperor. He actually was a friend, a present from a friend from Australia who brought him over from Australia.
We're going to also with us Daniel Jalkut, red-sweater.com, Red Sweater Software, one of my favorite.
Look at the back of his ground. No.
What does he have pictures of?
Yeah, nothing. Improvised corner here.
Yeah. Did your wife have to leave?
We have a big house. It's
okay. I feel bad.
Probably the kids were most impacted. We moved to the only room in my house that has a wired Ethernet connection, which is right where the TV is, of course. So,
I have the same problem. No, there's it has to be near the cable outlet.
Right. So I'll have to figure out how to wire this place up a little better.
Well, thank you for doing it, because I tell you what, great picture, great sound. It works wonderfully.
I'm glad it worked out in the end. Yeah.
Solved the problem. And of course, Andy Iannocco, who has cleverly sanitized his background to reveal nothing about himself.
The rest of my office is immaculate and spotless behind there. I put up the screen so you're not intimidated by the cleanliness and the order and the tidiness behind my office.
By the way, the rebuttal from the chat room is, yeah, penguins smell, but have you ever smelled humans? What do you think we smell like to penguins? They go, the penguins go, oh, God, what's that? Oh, it's more humans. Oh, if they could, they'd wave their little fins.
We invented breath mints. What have penguins done about that fish breath?
That's true. They perhaps like fish breath. They probably say, have a mackerel instead of have a breath mint. It's like, you're smelling a little like polar bear. Have a mackerel. Our show today brought to you by the and boy, are they proud, by the Adobe Marketing Cloud. These guys actually have done some great stuff. If you're a marketer, you know Adobe Marketing Cloud. They do a lot of white papers, a lot of interesting research. They help train people on using marketing more effectively. And now they've made audio, I guess I could call it a podcast. It's on iTunes, a podcast for reading their audio white papers. And they're hired really good readers. And they really are great. If you want to find them, go to iTunes and search for Audio White Papers for Marketing. If you're a marketing pro, or you know, just in business, and you want to market your business better and want to stay up to date on the latest marketing trends and technologies, these are great because they're all under a half an hour. You can listen to them on the way in. You'll learn so much, like the differences between interaction metrics, engagement metrics, and value metrics. Help you figure out which part of your creative is working. Creating personalized content that's relevant to customers using predictive analytics. Creating a 360-degree view of each customer, no matter where they're interacting with your brand, a lot more. Here's the best way to do it. Go to just open iTunes and search Audio White Papers for Marketing. Or you could Google Adobe Audio White Papers for Marketing. Or go to adobe.com for more information. It really is great. And they're free. By the way, did I mention free? Audio, and it's not a big sell for Adobe or anything. It's just really useful, valuable information. Audio White Papers for Marketing. We thank Adobe Marketing Cloud for their support of Mac Break Weekly. turns out that the Special Forces is no longer going to use a Samsung Galaxy phone. The Army Special Operations Command has ditched the Android. What are they going to use? The iPhone 6S, because they say it's faster and smoother. And when you're sneaking up on the enemy, you don't want to wait for the phone to load.
You got to make sure you flip that little switch so it doesn't ring accidentally.
Oh, God, that'd be
excuse me, let me take this.
That would be terrible. According to a source not authorized to speak to the media, which explains why he's talking to TechCrunch, the Samsung device that acts as the brain of the Android tactical assault kit is a clunker. Well, yeah, they're using a Note 2. That's four generations old.
And the battery's almost dead.
Yeah, it lags, it freezes, it needs to be rebooted. The iPhone 6S apparently is faster and smoother. And get this, a split-screen view of a drone's live video and the map showing its route, for instance, is better on Apple hardware. The source says, it's seamless on the iPhone. The graphics are clear. Unbelievable. Wow. So I didn't know this, but they had ATAC. They had the Android, tactical assault kit. This was a real thing. And I guess it'll now be iTAC.
Does it come up to Pokemon Go?
Yeah.
I wonder if the people in government who want Apple to, reduce the security of their
good point.
Talking to these guys because I always feel pretty good when I realize I've got a phone that apparently the U.S. military thinks is secure enough for their purposes. So, it kind of occurs to me. I had this thought earlier, Leo, and this is something I'm curious to get your take on. So you're talking about leaving the OS makers like Apple and Windows, Microsoft and stuff because you sort
only
because
they left me first.
Right. So one of the things that came to mind is I have a hard time imagining how security gets addressed quite as well as it does with Apple when there's not the sort of funding power of millions of customers buying hardware.
Well, that's a really interesting point of view. I'd never heard. Open source is inevitably more secure because the source code is published. You don't know what Apple's doing behind the scenes.
But I don't know that that's true because the source code being published means that anybody who has an incentive to crack it also has complete unfettered access to it. And,
there's bugs, absolutely. Right. The bugs will surface. But it's my they're going to surface anyway. They will surface and be fixed much faster. And the track record for open source software and security is, heartbleed aside, there are, in OpenSSH, there have been issues. But I think you're far more secure. And, by the way, you're less of an attack surface because if you're a bad guy, you're going after Windows, maybe Mac, and absolutely not FreeBSD. It's just not going to pay off. What are you going to get? A couple of neck beards in a closet. It's not. And me.
Yeah.
It's not. I think the security. And if you look at BSD particularly, now I'm going to use FreeBSD because it has a larger community. But if you go to OpenBSD, that is widely agreed by every security expert I know to be the most secure and private operating system. And because there is no commercial entity behind it, there's no incentive to gather your information. You fully control what's happening with it. So I think, Daniel, there's not a shred of doubt in my mind that I am not only more secure but more private using open source software.
Here's my concern. So I do agree on the whole that the source code being out there makes it more likely to be vetted for problems. The place where I'm still not quite with you is Apple has an incentive to make better security, not just to be more committed to security, not just to be like, I trust that all these FreeBSD, OpenBSD people are committed to security. But the question is, what kinds of things can Apple do, whether it's like coming up with better encryption algorithms, whether it's, usability stuff that just like makes it easier for you to sync your password, say, encrypted over the web. What is the sort of breadth of things to address user security issues that we sort of get, quote unquote, for free by funding Apple's massive enterprise that, you could have in purely open source stuff, it's limited to what those geniuses who happen to put their time into open source software are able to come up with. And I guess
this is a common question about open source in general. Like somebody asked me this on the radio show, mm-hmm. but where's the money in it? And, I think that you probably know, Daniel, that there's quite a few very accomplished programmers who do it for reasons other than the paycheck. Many of them do have day jobs and do this as a hobby. I think some of the top security people in the world are working in open source. Phil Zimmerman did PGP in open source. GPG, which is the truly open because he sold it, truly open version of PGP, benefits from that. I'm not convinced that the a commercial entity shares our interests in privacy and security. I admit they have the funding, but I don't know if money is the deciding factor. And I think that the, a lot of people, you know, people wonder, how does open source, why is there so much, why is Linux, you know, so why is that such a diverse ecosystem when there's no money in it? Because programmers do it for a variety of reasons besides money. You know that, Daniel.
Well, I know that absolutely, but I guess I've just, I don't know the, and I just don't, I'm just ignorant on that front about how much active, really like cutting edge security work is going on in the open source community. You may very well be completely right. It may outpace what Apple's doing. I guess I have a bias because I've been accepting Apple's marketing, right?
Yeah.
To some extent.
Yeah. Well, it outpaces it not only because they're, believe it or not, larger numbers of people working on it. But they don't have the same marketing commercial pressures that somebody working at Apple does, the same limitations. They're working at it because they care and they want it to be. And I think there probably is nobody more security and privacy focused than the open source community. I don't doubt in any way that they are every single one of them cares a lot about this. And the users care a lot about it, and that the users are the ones who are giving them feedback. So... I look into it because I think you'd be very impressed. In fact, and if you're going to use encryption, are you going to prefer FileVault over TrueCrypt? Actually, TrueCrypt's gone, but let's pick another open source program let's say Veracrypt. I far prefer to use Veracrypt. I don't know how. I know what white papers Apple publishes, and I really am grateful that Apple publishes those white papers because they're very forthcoming about their security. A little bit less so. We'll see what they say about differential privacy, which could be good or could be bad depending on how they implement it. We got to see the white papers on that. But at the same time, we don't know what's in that file vault blob. And in fact, due to the way the laws are written in this land, there absolutely could be governmental backdoors on it that Apple wouldn't be able to talk about.
Yeah. And the other thing is, it kind of ties into the story we just talked about. It's nice that the people in field operations now get to use a much faster and more responsive phone than a Note 2 when they're doing their very important jobs. But remember that was it 3 or 4 weeks ago that it got out that Obama finally has a smartphone and it is an Android device. That's not because Android is necessarily a better platform, but because it's a more open platform. It's more easy for the Department of Defense and others to customize all of the system software so that it can do the things that the president's phone needs to do. I wouldn't say that it's necessarily more secure to have an open source operating system, though, only because remember that the great advantage of open source software is also its greatest problem in that it assumes that you know what you're doing and you know what each parts in this engine are for and what they do. And so if there is a weakness somewhere inside your system, it understands that the implication is that you are a seasoned system administrator. You know that you're doing tests, you're doing a penetration operations on your own systems, and you know how to fix this. Whereas you're going to have with Apple, all that happens is with an Android phone, with an iPhone, with a Mac, you get a security update, you click OK, and then you hope that it doesn't blow up your system. But then your system is already investigated and patched.
Life is life. I mean, look, all life is trust, right? I mean, and using it, any software is trust unless you're writing it from scratch yourself. And, oh, by the way, let's go to the foundry and make our own chips while we're at it, because that's software too. So you have to trust people. I mean, one of the things about OpenBSD, which is interesting, is their decision is to make all the defaults secure. So if you, without knowing anything, installed OpenBSD on a computer, you would have probably and I think this is widely agreed, I'm not making this up, the most secured system possible. Now, you can, of course, break that security. But if you just install the defaults the way they've set that up, it would be highly secure. And then privacy issue is another issue. Now, it's funny because I give up privacy all the time, and that's my choice. But I think Apple pays lip service, But, you know, one of the things they don't want to talk about, and they're still not talking about, is the fact that they have the keys to your cloud, your iCloud. And, in fact, I inferred from the San Bernardino discussion that they willingly turn over people's iCloud information to law enforcement.
They have to.
They have to.
Yeah.
Right.
And what I was hoping to see at WWDC is some statement to the effect of, and we're going to encrypt your cloud. And I thought it was very telling in the absence of that.
Maybe they just don't have something in place yet. I don't know of any, not a lawyer. I've been the beneficiary of having a lot of very good lawyers confuse me with what the laws are for data retention. I don't know of any law that says that if Apple is storing stuff on behalf of customers, that they have to make sure that they have access to that data for the purposes of providing it to law enforcement. I do believe that Apple would try to do that. Their policy seems to be, our best defense against government intrusion is to make sure that even we do not have the ability to decrypt.
Right.
They
did that with messages. It's end-to-end encryption in messages. They've done that with the phone. I would really like to see them step up and say, and by the way, on iCloud, it's trust no one. Only you have the keys.
But they barely got iCloud working to, like, store a Mac write document and get the Mac write document back, you know, one thing at a time. And also, this is another reason why I too have like a cloud system on my home server, but I wouldn't. The thing is, I trust Dropbox to be very much, much better at securing that data than I am, given that I just want this darn thing to work. And once I get it working, particularly if it's a networking thing where I'm lucky to just make sure that, okay, the port forwarding works. I've been at this for 3 hours. I can access this from outside the office. I don't care anymore. I'm just going to go home and just chill out for a second there. Not everybody is going to be, they're experts on data security. Those people are paid a lot of money because they are very, very smart and they know how to harden your data against intrusion. I feel as though even giving my data to Google Drive makes it safer than relying solely on a box that I've put on my own network that I'm responsible for configuring. For all I know, I've added a Wi-Fi extender to my office here. For all I know, there's some sort of default password that was not documented that I don't know about that will allow pretty much anybody to get in, including the government.
Right.
They know that this dope has just been podcasting about how great it is that he's not trusting Dropbox or Apple anymore. He's got this box in his home network, and now the whatever three-letter agency is saying, oh, that's great. We don't need a warrant to take advantage of a box that he has willingly put on the internet but failed to secure successfully. This would be difficult if he was actually using a free account on Google Drive, but hey, he's just given us his daily diary.
Well, and as Scooter X points out in our chat room, it's very possible, maybe even likely, that if Apple did do end-to-end encryption, it would break a lot of functionality.
We
want things like syncing and the ability to log into your Apple account on the cloud and see your stuff. And maybe they decided it's not worth that.
If you look at some of the services that have done that, like CrashPlan, and I think SugarSync, one of SpiderOak, one of those.
SpiderOak does it, yeah.
SpiderOak. You have to basically, it creates a user barrier,
right,
to because you have to generate your password, your own encryption key and use that. Yeah. And again, you lose that key, you literally, no one's getting it back ever again. And I think Apple has enough times also gotten stuff back for people that for them, you know, support has done this, and that they probably are not super happy about losing that capability, right, as well.
I think, you know, look, for most people, it's fine.
Yeah,
even for me, it's fine. I'm not too worried about it.
You get to make a statement.
But for me, it's just my new game.
Yeah, right.
So how secure can I make it? How private can I make it? This is what I'm going to use, is a program called Sandstorm.io, which is a really interesting hosted platform. It runs on Linux, but it uses a really smart kind of encapsulation of all your data. So they're really focused, and you, of course, host it yourself. Everything's encrypted. And then you add apps. It's kind of interesting because you add apps. It has an app store. So you add apps to, add capabilities. WordPress is an app, for instance, There are a lot of apps in the I'll show you the app market. The word processors, every kind of Google Drive, kind of similar capability, Dropbox, similar capability. I'm really interested in replacing Evernote with this, with Permanote. I think there's some very, it's just to me, this is going to be fun. And by the way, It's really costly. I have to buy a server. I'm going to host it myself. I have to have the technical ability to do that. I also have to spend a significant amount of money on a wildcard cert, so it's got HTTPS. And who knows? It could break. All sorts of things could go wrong with it, and there could be a massive hole in it. So I know that to me, it's a game. I'm going to do this for fun and out of kind of a journalistic interest.
Right?
If you've won?
You only know if you've lost.
Yeah.
I really love that attitude. There are people who buy older cars, not necessarily because they're cheapskates or not even necessarily because they think that the 1963 whatever was the car of their dreams when their dad talked about it. But it's fun to have this closed box that you will learn stuff about, and it's insanely empowering when you get yourself to a level of gameplay where you realize that I feel as though I understand everything that's going on inside this box. I understand how all this software works. I understand how this interacts with the other. Nobody is shielding me from with a wizard on how this box now communicates with the rest of the world. So now if something bad happens, I know how to fix it.
And if you can do it, it's fun. And why not do it? I'm a geek. This is what I do for a living. This is what I do for my hobby. So of course I'm going to play with stuff like this. But I understand that very few will or should have to. So I welcome a company like Apple, at least putting a flag in the sand and say, we're going to do this. They need to.
Yeah.
And by the way, there's no good mobile solution for this. I mean, you know, if you want to carry a smartphone, you're carrying a spy device with you.
Raspberry Pi?
No.
That's why I think that there's a limit to how hardcore you can get about saying, see, this is why I use all Apple devices because of, yeah, but you're stepping outside into a world in which there are going to be devices that can be just wheeled out in public spaces and capture all the phone data, all the IDs of things.
And we know they do that. We know they use it, and they don't, and they gather everybody's information, not just the guy they're after's information.
It's
legal.
It's raining everywhere outside your house, and trying to have the goal of being completely dry all the time is not an attainable goal. The best thing to do is to make sure that the water is not going to hurt you or get you sick.
And by the way, I'm about to buy a car that if I do anything wrong, the guy who runs the company will blog about it. Because he has all the telemetry from everything I do.
Yeah.
So try and buy a private car, I tell you. Let's see here. What else? So Apple did a song royalty rate proposal, and I don't know enough about the business to know if this is good or bad or what. Apple, given its power in this industry, probably will win. Apple wants every service that offers streaming music to pay 9.1 cents per 100 plays, which seems like a weird way to say it, but I guess you don't want to say 0.9 cents per play or 0.09 cents per play. So that would be very straightforward. It would also end free tiers, or if Spotify had a free tier, it would be coming straight out of their pocket at a rate of 9.1 cents per 100 plays. And in fact, the New York Times says this is a direct attack at Spotify. This has to be approved by the Librarian of Congress, I believe, if I'm not mistaken. The Copyright Royalty Board is a panel of federal judges who oversee these rates in the United States. It's apparently fairly complicated right now, and musicians have a hard time figuring out what they should be getting.
Well, is this the flat tax proposal?
Yeah, this is the flat tax of the music world. That's exactly what this is.
How many songs do you have to play in a month before you get, up to a point where that's challenging a business model? Like, so 9.1. Oh, wait, we say 9 cents for 100 songs. So 9 cents for every 300 minutes of streaming music. Seems like you'd have to play an awful lot of songs to cost Apple or Spotify enough that your monthly membership wouldn't.
No, but that's the point. It would put them out of the free business, and that's and that Spotify considers problematic.
Oh, because right? There's no way chance they're making 9.9 cents on the ads.
Right.
Yeah.
So, gotcha. It's interesting because when Apple did something Spotify considered anti-competitive earlier, refusing to allow Spotify's app in the App Store, Spotify made a big deal about it. They haven't said a word about this, which makes me think that maybe they've come to some sort of agreement with Apple, or I don't know, maybe they gave up. Maybe they're hoping to get bought. I wouldn't be surprised if Apple said, you know, we could just write you a check. And if I were Spotify, if I were Daniel Ek, I'd be looking for a check right about now because this is a tough business.
But is Apple the one to do that? Because
they don't need them, probably. But
they don't need them, and then there's also a competitive issue maybe, right?
Maybe. There's a lot. There's Tidal, and you know, there was a rumor that Apple's trying to buy Tidal, right? Jay-Z's company.
So I was just looking. I was curious what the CPM, or the cost per thousand, is to advertise on Spotify and how that compares. Unfortunately, it turns out you can't just find that information.
No,
you have to actually ask Spotify and then negotiate.
Yeah.
So it'd just be interesting to see what how much Spotify actually makes on the ads and how that compares to the whole 9.1 cents. And why 9.1? I mean, as long as you're pulling a number out of a hat, why not 10? Like 9
Make
or
it 10. 10? Make it 10 sounds right? Better, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, just really, 9.1?
It's magic. It's a magic.
Yeah.
Jim Dalrymple, I think, will be happy. He will be pleased. Apple has decided to take the audio fingerprint feature from iTunes Match that apparently helps iTunes Match from making mistakes. Although, if you ask me, they still make mistakes with iTunes Match. They're going to bring it to their Apple Music. They've also announced that they will no longer put DRM on your cloud music with Apple Music. I'm not sure. I didn't know why they were doing that in the first place. Jim, who, of course, has been on the show many times, he's at the Loop Insight, loopinsight.com, was one of the people who complained that Apple had deleted some of his music. Maybe this will make it better. I don't know.
Yeah, it's going to be a real question, but iTunes Match is $25 a year, and Apple Music is $10 a month. So there's a big discrepancy there, and I have a feeling that wouldn't be surprised if iTunes Music went away or iTunes Match went away.
Oh yeah, that makes sense. Well, yeah, as you start adding Match features to music,
precisely. I mean, they bring the audio fingerprinting, they bring the other stuff. Suddenly, $25 a year was just too good a deal.
Yeah,
yeah, but that's they're bringing this in to solve a big problem. The third rail of this this adoption is trust us with your music library. We will only screw it up. Kind of. A little in places.
As long as you don't have anything too weird in there, you're going to be good.
Yeah.
I mean, stick with the best of albums, the stuff you see advertised on TV. Everything K-Tel. Will be fine. K-Tel Records.
No, I wound up having to buy secondhand a new copy of one of my favorite CD, a two CD set of the Who's live tour in 1989, and disc two is they play the entirety of Tommy from start to finish live.
I saw that tour, by the way. It was awesome.
Oh God, I'm jealous. It's just amazing. And when I said a few weeks ago that I'm rebuilding my entire library, and that's the time when I found out that at some point iTunes had melded the live CD with like actual tracks from like the studio album of Tommy. So you'll get like this incredibly dynamic, like 1800 piece orchestra with 50,000 feet chanting, and then do you think it's all right?
Like, what a way to ruin an album.
Happened? So just to make sure, because this is a library that I'm not even letting iTunes ever see. I just went and bought a secondhand copy of it, re-ripped it in ALAC, and so now I have it all like good and intended. So it's a problem. They're going to fix this. Oddly enough, though, my opinion of Apple Music has gone up quite a bit. This is going to sound like a backhanded compliment, but it isn't. Once you make the decision that I'm never going to let it see my actual owned library ever. Once you simply say this is a subscription music service that gives me curated playlists, recommendations, live radio, and the ability to sample entire albums, that's great. It's a really, really superlative service, and it might be the best monthly. It's the only of the three different services that I have a lot of experience with, not counting Amazon Prime, because I'm going to be buying Amazon Prime anyway. I think that it's the one that I would keep if I had to only keep one. But between Spotify, Google Music, and Apple Music, again, given the rules that this service will never, ever, ever, ever even know where I hide all my music, because it's like when mom or dad, that they're great, but when they drink, just make sure you keep your homework books, make sure you keep your bicycle hidden away for them, because something bad's going to happen to it.
Dad always takes the bicycle and goes and gets ice cream.
I will admit, Andy, that I think that's a good approach. I mean, I gave up on Apple Music after the 3 month trial.
What do you use? Do you use Spotify, Adam?
I use Spotify. Yeah. I don't like Spotify particularly, but I used Ardio, and I liked Ardio a lot. So Spotify's interface is ugly as sin, and it really doesn't provide the kind of discovery. And I just ran into this. Did you know there's a limit on how many tracks you can save?
I did not.
Yeah, I hit it. I don't know what it is.
What is the number, though? It must be pretty big.
Yeah, but see, the way I like doing this was kind of doing the, you know, follow the path. You know, yeah. I start with a song I like.
So you would cache everything as you listen to it, you download it, yeah.
Well, not download, just literally add to my songs list.
Oh, and there's a limit to that?
There's a limit to that.
Oh, there shouldn't be a limit to that. I can see how they might have a limit to how many you could download.
Nope, this is just literally adding to a list.
Oh, that's weird.
10,000 or something.
That must be a soft. Jeez, you have a lot. That's a long list.
you could start a new list,
Adam. You could have list two.
Well, that's the thing, is I don't know if it's playlists or if it's just literally my songs list.
Oh, I get it.
It was like, really? There's a limit? Who
actually, 10,000 is low. I mean, most of these services, 25,000. You know, Google Music, I think it's more. It's 50.
Yeah.
Jim says this is the biggest change. One of the most significant updates to come to the service since it was introduced. He says, if you're currently an iTunes Match and Apple Music subscriber, as he was, you probably won't see much of a difference. But if you're an Apple Music subscriber that doesn't have iTunes Match, you're going to start to see Matched as a check mark in the iCloud status column of your iTunes on your Mac. So it's going to start matching your music. I love iTunes Match. I can live without Apple Music because, like you, I have Spotify. I also have Google Music. But I love iTunes Match. And frankly, it's the kind of thing you might just buy for 1 year, match everything, and then back it up. Not to get back on this open source kick, but one of the things that the Sandstorm server has is a music player. And I'm going to try putting all of the music I have on this cloud. And then I could play it from the web. I could stream it from the web on my phone or anywhere else.
I really think that one of the best investments you can make, especially if you have a family inside the house, is to just spend $250 or $500 on a NAS.
Hard drives are cheap
because they're cheap. The box itself only costs $100-$200 if you want to get like a family type one to put 4 terabytes or 8 terabytes of storage. Is only another $200 or $300. And every time you think about a solution that you need to have, if you just log into your NAS and bring up the desktop and take a look at what's available for it, you'll realize that there is actually an entire remote access.
Right.
I can basically build my own version of Apple Music on this device and access. And there'll be Android apps, there'll be Apple TV apps, there'll be Roku apps, and there'll be iOS apps.
What's missing?
Accessing my movies and music everywhere.
Is Sonos and Amazon Echo. And I've got to figure out a way that I can use a local source, you know, of music and use it and play it on my... Because Echo does Spotify now, which is... I mean, actually, it always did Spotify, but I could make that my default.
Yeah. I've paid for like the unlimited music storage on Amazon, and so I just have like I don't know what the sync script is, but it just basically syncs my master library to Amazon Music.
There's a little app that runs in the
exactly.
Background.
So and because Amazon Echo, of course, is going to be intimate with the Amazon Music library. That's how I get it working. But yeah, I really wish I could just simply point my device my. I don't want to say it. Point Alexa at the NAS and say, this is where I want you to get music from now on, please. Plex.
Wouldn't that be nice?
Would be the best thing. Yeah.
I think that'll happen.
Yeah.
I'm loving iOS 10 messages, playing with it a lot. I was able to convince my poor wife to switch to iOS 10 just so I could use it with her, because otherwise I don't know anybody. I can message her and Renee Ritchie. But
Tough choice.
Bad news. They're not going to support those new things on Mac OS, according to Macworld magazine.
Yeah, I think that there's a technical problem because the I haven't looked into it too carefully, but isn't part of this whole deal that, you know, developers can make their own sort of additions to messages? And I think it's all based on iOS touch stuff. It's all based on UIKit, which is not available.
The API doesn't come over.
Yeah, right. So unless Apple were to do some major thing, you know, as they've intermittently been rumored to do, like somehow bringing UIKit to the Mac, then I think that they couldn't just like flip a switch and say, okay, all this fancy stuff for messages now also works on the Mac.
I understand what you just said, but I think the average user is going to go, what do you mean?
Right.
What you're going to get is descriptive text. You know, Leo sent you a message with exploding fireworks.
Yeah. I think it's a problem. I mean, to be honest, and I think there's other problems. They're actually kind of closing up the gap to a great extent, you know, things like Siri coming to the Mac. But to the extent that you kind of can't do the same things on a Mac as you can on an iOS device when it makes sense, I think that that is a problem for Apple, whether it's technical in nature or not, doesn't really matter. It is frustrating if you know, something that makes just as much sense to do on an iOS device or a Mac device if you can do it on one and not the other. So I think that's a challenge they should try to sort of address over the years.
I don't know how
well they'll do it.
I mean, that's one of the strengths of messages, that I can sit down at a desktop or a laptop and continue the conversation. And often I do that because I like the keyboard support is much easier than this on-screen tapping.
I agree.
I'm not going to talk about the iPhone 7 because it's not here yet. So I'm not going to talk about it. It's not here yet. And I'm not going to talk about Pokemon Go because I haven't been able to play all day. The servers are down or something.
Oh, I thought you were just going to say you've been busy. And so
I'm trying to play right now. What are you talking about?
Yeah.
Hey, I got my priorities.
You know, it's funny how many people thought that, I can't believe that all these companies are wasting time on augmented reality and virtual reality. Apple is so smart to not even like talk about messing with that. But all you need is one app that everybody loves. Say, yeah, I think is there any place I could try out a HoloLens? That might be kind of fun.
There is a Pokemon Go hack that puts it on the HoloLens, which might be really cool, right? Nintendo has
doesn't keep you from looking like a dork walking around a public park.
Nintendo has like benefited. Oh no, but so what? You know, because it doesn't matter because you got to catch them all. And
you look like a dork, but you feel like Ash. That's how you sell the HoloLens.
Oh man, this is just frustrating as heck. I can't. It won't. By the way, Nintendo is now more valuable than Sony.
Wow.
Its value has doubled because of an app.
So well, when you beat Twitter in 2 weeks.
Yeah.
It's a little I will say that's impressive.
And I don't I don't know about where you guys are, especially you, Adam. You probably don't have a lot of pokey stops in your neighborhood.
Actually, we have Cornell, so yeah, Cornell's already been sending out
anywhere there's a college.
Yeah. They've been sending out mail saying, you really can't just go in any building you want. Some of them are off limits. And, you know.
Oh, man.
This might be my age talking, but I remember when I went to school, it was really, really hard to put myself through school, but I could at least put myself through school. I can't imagine how upset I would be as a parent to say, we're paying $38,000 a year to send you to school.
60.
I'm talking about the state's college. You're not going to spend any time looking for invisible Pokemon.
Dude.
You're going to spend time figuring out how you can get a job and start paying us back for at least some of this.
This is how it's always been. Stephen King spent his entire college career playing hearts. Bill Gates played bridge at Harvard for all the years he was there, and then he dropped out. How do you think his parents felt? Man, it's lucky he became the richest man in the world, because otherwise...
If he had Pokemon Go, he never would have done DOS.
He played bridge kind of incessantly, I'm told, in college. That was like nonstop. And I remember there were a lot of people in college like that who just, whatever it was, be it the bong, be it the hearts, they just didn't stop, right? That's all they did. And I look at my son, who has joined a frat, and I do hope he's learned something in the 4 years and $100,000 later.
Remember, class, it's beer, then liquor, never sick.
So here's what's interesting to me about this Nintendo valuation thing, Leo. Like you said, they like doubled their right. value or something.
They did.
That's based on ownership. They only have 33% ownership of the Pokemon company.
You see? 30% ain't bad. You see? You see what I'm saying?
There you go. But here's what's interesting. I just this thought pops into my mind. It seems like Nintendo got disproportionately more valuable.
They did.
Than, I don't know.
Because you know who else has, I think more than 30% is Google.
Well, right. The Niantic part of this.
It's spun off from Google. And Google has a big stake in Niantic.
And I guess I don't know how they split their money, how the revenue is planned to be split on this. But it just goes to show that just making the Pokemon brand sort of resurging value, I guess, is enough for people to just get excited about Nintendo.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think actually, I mean, to be fair, the reason the stock market likes it, first of all, stock market is mercurial at best, right? You know, but the reason the stock market likes it is because Nintendo's been struggling with hardware, and it shows that there is a path forward in software for Nintendo, and that that what they have that's very valuable is their IP, their intellectual property, their characters, and those can be monetized. So I think the stock market's probably saying, oh, they're, you know, we thought Nintendo was done, and they're not. Okay, let's, as long we're talking about money and acquisitions, ARM. Whoa. ARM, which, of course, was a spinoff of Acorn Computer, the BBC computer. They spun off ARM. Apple put a huge chunk in it for the Newton. They needed a mobile chip. Apple was one of the founders, in effect, of ARM and had a huge stake in it, which they sold off. ARM powers almost every mobile device you use, your iPhone, your iPad. Yes, I know it's the Apple A7, but that's based on an ARM architecture. ARM never made the chips. ARM only designed the chips and then licensed the design to companies like Apple. Billions of chips a year in almost every smartphone, just purchased by SoftBank, which I used to work for SunSan. SoftBank owned Ziff Davis briefly. And when I was working for ZDTV, $32 billion. The founder of ARM says it's a dark day for Britain. Wouldn't be the first time. Wouldn't be the first dark day for
first time
Britain
that happened
this week.
This summer?
Yeah.
SoftBank
has been at great pains, and I believe this, to say, no, you know what? We're not taking any of the engineers out of Britain, they're all going to stay there. The founders are going to stay there. The people running the company are going to stay there. SoftBank's become increasingly more like Berkshire Hathaway, and a company that invests in companies. So I don't think SunSan has any desire or intention to bring ARM to Japan. Nevertheless, they now own, and you know what? If you put it this way, they own the chip that powers all mobile computing and will power all Internet of Things. $32 billion is a pretty good deal.
I think it's pretty interesting. I don't know a ton about this, but I know that Apple, I think, has an unusual deal with ARM still, even though they don't own any of it. If my memory is right, they have a kind of unusual license that allows them to make their own chips to the ARM spec. So it sort of gives them an amount of freedom that I think most ARM licensees don't have, because they have to buy ARM chips off the shelf from other makers. So I wonder if that makes them like sweat a little less about things like major changes in ownership of ARM. I don't know if any of you has
I think Apple's been moving toward doing their own thing for a while anyway, right? They have more than 1,000 chip designers working for them.
Right. And I guess what's valuable about that license, the way I remember hearing about it, is basically like they got that license at the right time in history where they're now, I think, empowered to continue making their own ARM architecture chips.
Regardless.
Whereas like it might be one of those situations, like the other comparison that comes to mind is PDF. Like, you know, Apple got that PDF license really early on. Right. So they were able to integrate it into the OS. And I think that's those kinds of licenses that they own some of these licenses where I don't think if they went to the company now they'd get the license.
Do you know if they get though from ARM the new designs? You know, the A8, the A, or whatever they call it, the Cortex 8. As the new designs come out, does Apple get those, look at them, and incorporate them into their chips, or is it as Apple now on their own moving forward?
I don't know, but my assumption would be that they have some kind of like, because I don't think this is a license, and I'm really speaking with no knowledge about this, but it doesn't strike me that this is a license that has to be like perennially updated with new,
right,
you know, ARM stuff. I think it's sort of like they got something really, really low level in the ARM architecture where they, you know, they call it an architectural license. So I think what it means is they're sort of allowed to
parody it. They're doing homage to ARM.
Yeah, right. Well, yeah,
I guess they can adjust it or design their own. I was just researching this too. And yeah, an architecture license allows them to take the ARM cores and adjust them. So most people would just be able to, you know, license the actual thing and use it. But
by the way, Apple never mentions ARM, right? I mean, they don't say the A7 is based on the ARM. It's just,
right. And it's probably that architectural license that allows them to make a chip that completely complies with whatever it is they need from the ARM architecture and does other stuff.
Right.
Like, I don't know, having the secure enclave and all this other Apple only junk,
right,
which you certainly wouldn't be able to buy.
There's also a claim here that Apple does not use ARM designs. They use certain principles present in the ARM architecture and the ISA.
So it's almost a patent light. It's almost at the level of, you know, you're not going to sue us for doing some of the same things you do at this point. Yeah.
Maybe.
Yeah. I would bet that this doesn't really affect Apple, except to maybe hasten their desire to be armless.
There had been some discussion of Apple looking to acquire ARM, but that was about a year ago.
I feel like this is a good acquisition because how many IoT devices are on the horizon?
Yeah.
You know, Raspberry Pi uses ARM. Every smartphone uses ARM. Everybody uses ARM.
Yeah, I think you're really onto something with the question of whether it's so much like a patent that other companies would be infringing just by using some of those principles, right? So, if there is that value to just owning the idea of an ARM style architecture, then certainly seems like it's not going anywhere.
Well, it's okay because Apple has cornered the market on sensor-equipped LED smart jump ropes. So that's going to be a huge business going forward.
Wait till it's integrated with Pokemon Go.
We honestly believe it's the best hunk of rope that's ever been made.
This is going to be, you'll find them at Apple retail stores and online. It's the Tangram Smart Rope. It uses magnetic sensors attached to ball bearings in the handles to count every jump, sending it to your iPhone and your Apple Watch. And
you can see a really bad graph in the health app.
Yeah. And 23 LEDs are built into the rope, which flash thousands of times per minute to create an animated effect in midair.
Oh, well, that's cool.
So this will be a new Olympic sport in 4 years. you want to see the video? Let's watch. The evolution of a classic. Jumping rope, right? Isn't that a good exercise? It's what boxers do, right? What's that? Oh my God, it's so the LEDs are projecting the number of jumps onto the wall in front of you.
No, it's persistence of vision.
Well, whatever.
Whatever, okay, basically.
Whatever, it looks like they're on the wall. I see, you're seeing...
It's like, you ever seen those novelty things where you have a bank of LEDs that spins? Yeah, there you go.
Yeah, you're seeing the rope because you're seeing it out of the corner of your eye.
Pretty cool.
Yeah, well, that's cool. All right, I mocked it, I was wrong. Opera has just been sold to a China. This is bad. The Opera browser to a Chinese consortium for $600 million. The Norwegian company sold the browser, the performance apps, the name. Bye bye, Opera. It's not the biggest browser in the world. Although mobile, they have a decent percentage. I think. Let me see. It was in the article here.
It's small on the desktop.
Desktop's
10%
like 1%
of mobile.
Yeah. So 10's not bad, right? All right, I think I'm done. Do you want to talk about Apple Pay, Touch ID coming to 70,000 ATMs across the U.S.?
I think we talked about that last week, didn't we?
Did we?
We talked a little bit about it.
Yeah, that's good. That's good. That's enough. Just a mention. All right. Let's unless somebody has something they want to talk about, we can move on and get our picks of the week.
Yeah, I'm happy.
Daniel, this is a new feature of the show where we ask, are you happy?
Uh-oh. Introspection time.
Mm-mm.
I'm happy.
You're happy. Are you happy, Adam?
And rank your happiness before the show.
On a scale of 1 to 10, how much pain are you in?
Have you ever seen the 1 to 10, the real 1 to 10 pain scale that a cartoonist did?
No.
Oh, this is fabulous. Because if you look at the ones in the hospital, it's like, you know, you have to get up to 3 or 4 before the face isn't smiling. Yeah. You know, whereas I think
any
this
pain.
Cartoonist did this. Yeah. I think you can find it while I'm talking.
Is it Lucille Picard? Is that...
I think so. Basically, the last one is like, a bear is eating my entrails.
It's got to be XKCD, right?
A bear is
eating my entrails.
It's much, much more accurate for those who actually have had pain, you know, from surgeries or whatnot. You're trying to report to the doctors like, well, you know, it's like someone's hitting me in the head with a blunt instrument, you know, or
it is, you know, XKCD or maybe not, but here's an XKCD.
This isn't it, but there's another one that's better. But yeah.
All right.
But yes, it's pretty impressive.
All right. Let's take a break. Ladies and gentlemen, we'll have your picks of the week in a minute, but first get ready to get hungry, because I'm going to talk about Blue Apron. I love Blue Apron. Blue Apron's mission statement. You ready? My mouth is already watering. Talk about a Pavlovian reaction. Somebody just rang the bell. Blue Apron. I love Blue Apron. Blue Apron's mission is to make incredible home cooking accessible to everyone while supporting a more sustainable food system, setting the highest standard for ingredients, and building a community of home chefs. And they do it by getting you to make the most delicious meals you have ever had. Now, I know you don't want to go to the Applebee's tonight for dinner, but you're gonna, because who wants to plan a meal and go shopping and then, you know, it could be worse. You might end up at the Burger King. Well, here's the beauty part. You choose the day. One day a week, you come home and there's the Blue Apron box on your porch. Inside, three delicious meals. Meals for two or meals for your family. There's a family plan and a couples plan. And everything you need to make that fresh from the farm. Seafood is sourced sustainably and never frozen. The beef is raised humanely. The chickens are free range. The pork is raised naturally. The produce comes from 150 local farms. It's just what you need. If you need four asparagus spears, it's four, not three, not five. There's no waste. You get a card in there with the exact instructions on how to make the meal in under 40 minutes. And there's videos online too, pictures, everything you need. So even if you've never cooked in your life, you're going to make it the most amazing gourmet meal you've ever had. And I'll tell you, for date night, to impress, it is just light a couple of candles, get a nice bottle of wine, and you're golden, baby. You're golden. And with the kids, it's great. In fact, the Blue Apron did some research. And it says that Blue Apron families cook together nearly three times more often. The kids love it, and you're teaching them a life skill, frankly. Go to blueapron.com and take a look at the menu for this week. You choose what you want. Never get anything you don't want. You will, though, and I encourage you to be adventurous. Be trying things maybe you've never had before, whether it's, you know, Japanese ramen noodles, wild-caught Alaskan salmon, heirloom tomatoes. You're going to get the best of the best. Meals like... I don't know what it is, but it sounds good. Spicy ponzu glazed catfish with garlic rice. My mouth is watering uncontrollably at this point. Sesame, zucchini, and ginger peanuts. Fresh basil fettuccine with sauteed cherry tomatoes and zucchini. And you're going to make it, and you're going to make it right, and you're going to feel good about it. And, you know, the next time you're going to have the confidence to go, I can make that. You're in the store. You go, I should pick up some of that great ponzu glaze because I'm going to make catfish tonight, baby. Check out this week's menu. And we're going to get you your first three meals free, including free shipping. They ship to 99% of the continental U.S. by going to blueapron.com/twit. blueapron.com/twit.
Twit. You will love how good it feels and tastes to create incredible home-cooked meals with Blue Apron. BlueApron.com/Twit. You really have to try it. Time for our picks of the week. Let's start with Andy and not go here.
I've been really excited about this since I started beta testing it earlier this year. Finally, Scrivener, my favorite word processor, is coming to iOS. It's going to be released. We're recording on Tuesday the 19th. It's going to be released tomorrow the 20th. And they've done a whole blog post about it at Literature and Latte, the website. So I can talk about it. And it's just amazing. Now, it's always been my favorite word processor because it's not just here is a document and write your document and then print it or email it to someplace. It's always been for the best word processor for writing projects, such as a whole novel, a whole nonfiction book. I've written a couple of different, like an entire, like 400 or 500 page tech books entirely in Scrivener. If you're doing like a thesis paper where it's not just the stuff that you're writing, chapter after chapter after chapter, but it's also all the research that you're doing and all the outlines you're making and all the random scraps of notes. This is no other app can tie all this together into one nice organized pile like Scrivener can. So it's always been like my go-to app for the Mac. And this is, they've spent a couple of years trying to make an iOS version of it. And they did an entire restart of it last year. And what they wound up with is an app that is one of the most beautiful, one of the most powerful apps that's ever been made for iOS, I think. It really does. I'm unfortunately, I've been liking it so much that even in beta, I've been doing like real work with it. So I can't really show you like all, I can't really show you the real app because a lot of this is like kind of like secret
his
stuff that I can't really
play,
show you.
His novel.
Well, no, stuff that's not ready to show yet. But I mean, for instance, I'm doing a lot of research on, you might have heard me talk about this piece of art that I'm doing research on. And this has to really live as a Scrivener doc because I know that I'm going to write something about it. And I'm writing actually notes and stories as they come to me and actually coming up with data. Only like Scrivener will allow me to put this in this really nice, and you can't really see it there again. I should have done a screen capture. Maybe I'll do it later on. But, Only Scrivener lets you do stuff like I have an entire folder here called research that I can tap on and I can get every single piece of research by topic in a hierarchy here. Stuff that isn't really something I've written yet can be things like I have a photo just for folder just for photos, so I can tap on that and see now all the stuff that I've been finding online on my iPad. And just drill down and just see all the stuff that I've been finding. And so I've got it someplace nice and organized so that when I need to refer back to it, it'll work really, really nicely. And it's a really, really studly iOS app. It does support split screen. So I can have my Scrivener research while I'm in Safari someplace else or while I'm doing reading stuff elsewhere. And it syncs beautifully to the desktop version of Scrivener for Mac. It uses Dropbox as a conduit. I don't think there's support. I have to double check. I'm not sure if they're actually supporting any other cloud services yet. Just Dropbox. I don't know if they changed it since the last time that I checked the notes, but it's really just it makes me love the fact that I bought my iPad Pro. It makes me love the fact that I decided that Scrivener was the best word processor on the planet for me several years ago, and it's just another reason why I can keep my MacBook Pro at home and just use this. Even if I didn't, even if I weren't using it on the Mac or on Windows, I feel as though this would be a great thing even to use just as a standalone app on iOS. Now, there are an app that's kind of in the same category. It's called Ulysses that will also let you organize files by folder and project. What I like to say is that Ulysses is they both have the same kind of attitude. Ulysses is very, very simple, which means that you will be able to get it and get all the power out of it almost immediately. But it is limited to pretty much just text files. You can't really format things. You can't really export everything from there and make it into a book, for instance, or put it into something like Word or something bigger like that, or at least not very easily. Scrivener is something that you'll use it at a very basic level for the first month, and then when you start realizing, oh wait, what am I using an outliner for? I think there's supposed to be an outliner here, and then you start thinking in terms of, oh wait, here are all these features that I could be taking advantage of that for organizing my data, organizing my thoughts, plotting things out. I do have a couple of novels in Scrivener, and a lot of them just simply start off as an empty Scrivener project with just simply one note card that has the entire story in two sentences. And then I figure, well, actually, it'll end. I don't know what happens after that, but it ends like this. So there's another note card that simply says the ending. And then 2 months later, I've got a complete outline, many scenes all written out, a couple chapters actually written. And Scrivener allows me to organically figure out where this piece of writing is going. It really is beautifully tilled and cultivated soil to grow ideas in. So can't speak highly enough of it. It's going to be available starting tomorrow from Literature and Latte, and I believe also the iOS App Store. $20, worth it. I really want to I have a free version of it, but this is the sort of thing where I'm basically going to definitely be sending them real money because I want them to have money for this. Like I said, it's if Apple does not feature this on the App Store, and actually the next time they talk about the iPad, give people a demo of this to show how beautiful an app that's intended for a large screen can be, they're kind of silly. It'll also work on the iPhone, by the way, but on the iPad, it really stretches its legs. You can tell by my tone of voice, really excited about this because I'm the guy who tells you don't entrust real data and real projects to beta software. But there was such a lack of anything even similar to this for the iPad that I'm like, to hell with Andy. I'm going to start developing this project on the iPad instead because I like Scrivener too much.
Scrivener for iOS, S, and OS X, and Windows 10 of all things. Daniel, you got a pick? Something you want to highlight? Tell us about.
I have a pick for you, and you know I like to promote indie software developers, the little guys, right? Mm-hmm. So I have one from Verizon Wireless, the software that came to mind because I recently traveled to England for 2 weeks, and this is a problem that you may be familiar with if you ever travel internationally and you refuse to pay the exorbitant roaming fees of your carrier. Of course, if you have an unlocked phone, more and more of us do these days, you just buy one of these cheap SIM cards in the countries you're visiting. And then you have this challenge because from that point forward, you can't get any of your SMS messages, which isn't really a problem if you're doing things like iMessage or using WhatsApp or Snapchat or whatever other way you have of keeping up with your friends. But it is a problem for especially things like two-factor authentication. You want to log into Twitter or something. If you've got two-factor authentication set up, it wants to text you a code. And this has always been really anxiety-inducing for me when I travel because I really don't want to pay the outlandish data fees. But I thought there was no way to continue getting my SMS messages while on the run. And the truth is, I have to hand it to Verizon. Not only does this Message Plus app on the iTunes App Store, not only is it, you know, free, not only does it do what it says, which is bring SMS messages to my attention, even when I don't have my Verizon SIM card installed, but it's actually, you know, it seems to actually kind of work well. And it, you know, would do things like pop up on my, notifications would come through instantly. I tested it a few times before I left and, you know, texting myself, and they pop up instantly. It's funny, when you install it, it tries to encourage you to turn off iMessage, which is just a dumb idea. But, because you do want to keep your iMessage if you have relationships that, you know, chats with people by iMessage. But what's great about this app is it just fills that hole where you could no longer get SMS anymore on your native, you know, telephone number. So I recommend this to anybody who has Verizon and is planning to leave the country and you want that flexibility to be able to buy a SIM card. And I wonder if, you know, I haven't researched because I'm not an AT&T customer, but I wonder if there's something similar. It's worth looking into because I don't know. Have you guys ever done that, left the country and then suddenly realized you don't have your SMS, or do you usually just kind of try to get by on Wi-Fi, et cetera.
Brendan Barrett on the damn data plan.
The damn data plan, right.
Do Google Fi, baby. Get Google Fi. You won't ever have to worry about this. It has, it's amazing. You get the full, you get your full service everywhere you go.
Mm. Yeah, but then I wouldn't get my iMessages.
Oh, that. Yeah.
It's just a little thing called platform lock-in.
Yeah.
Well, gotcha. you weren't going to get your iMessages anyway. Just
give it up. Right. Oh, I know you like it when the emojis get really big, really big. What do you got for us, Adam Inkst?
Well, I'm going to go for something that's everyone has it. Preview.
Yeah.
It's in your applications folder.
It's awesome.
And Preview. We started, Josh Sunners, my managing editor, and I started writing some articles about Preview. And the deeper we got into it, the more we just kept saying, my goodness, this app has so many features. It's incredibly deep. Did you know you can open hundreds of images in a single window? You can trash them with a keystroke. You can move images from within Preview. You can play slideshows of PDFs if you want it. You can even edit an image live while looking at the original version of the image. It's amazing what Preview can do. People have no idea. So we wrote this bunch of tidbits articles, and then we actually got requests for this, so we have
take
just turned it
control
into
of Preview.
Take control of Preview.
Wow.
Out today.
Wow.
And
that's awesome.
Let me tell you, you wouldn't think that you could write 166 pages about Preview until you get into the app and you're like, holy cats, it can import from scanners. It can import from your iPhone. You know, it can put encryption, both types of password encryption on your PDFs, all sorts of things. We were just shocked at how capable this app is. I want to know who are the developers in Apple behind Preview, because this is a truly classic Mac app.
Yeah.
It has a ton of keyboard shortcuts. They all make sense. You know, Control Command A gives you an arrow instantly. You know, stuff like that, where it's like once you've learned them, the app is just brilliant. And there's things that you don't think about, like when you're working on an image, all the things you add to it are in layers, and you can't control the layers. It's not Photoshop, but you can, by duplicating and then duplicating something and then erasing deleting the original one, you can actually change the order of the layers. So if you want to overlay something, there's all these techniques we figured out while writing this book, and I just want to encourage people to play with Preview, because man, does this app have features.
Very nice. It's one of those things that we've had it for so long, we just kind of take it for granted. So it's nice to be reminded of all the things it can do.
I mean, just, you know, context sheet view, thumbnails view. Yeah. You can collaborate. Yeah. You can annotate a PDF and then go through in the sidebar all the annotations right there.
How much are those take control books?
$15.
And you find them on iBooks. Or would you rather I go to tidbits.com?
Well, I would rather. I'm not going to be shy about this. I'd rather you bought them for me. The fact is, it doesn't make any difference, you know, in the ratings or anything in iBookstore. So you buy them from us, then we can much more easily send you email when there's free updates, whenever. So actually, so you saw that picture I had on the webpage?
Yeah.
I learned two new techniques that are not in the book while doing that picture.
Oh, that's hysterical.
So we're going to have to do a free update and give that to everyone.
That's hysterical. Adam Inkst, thank you. Always a pleasure. And now I'm going to have you close your eyes if you're watching and listen to these sounds and see if anything comes to you.
Sesame Street.
A dim memory from your past.
I've got past. That monochrome graphics flashing before my eyes.
This is a test of how long you've been using a Mac.
Yep.
If you hear that bat sound and you get chills, I know you're an old timer. This is a great game, isn't it? Dark Castle. We love the game.
Yeah.
I'm gonna read some names. See if you recognize. First, let me close Dark Castle because I won't be able to do this. See if you know the name Robin and Rand Miller, right? Or Andrew Welch, yep. Or Matt Birch, or maybe. I don't know, maybe names like Brian Greenstone or Dave Marsh ring a bell. If they do, you're a Mac gamer from way back, and I think you'll be interested in this Unbound project, The Secret History of Mac Gaming. It's only 72% funded, And it is a book about the independent gaming scene early on in the world of Mac. Of course, Robin and Rand Miller did that very famous, that I can't remember the name of it. You know what I'm talking about. The HyperCard stack that became Myst with a Y. Crystal Quest Glider. Remember that? John Calhoun's Glider.
Rick Holtzgraff.
Yeah. Mark Steven Pierce did Dark Castle. So the 60 plus interviews with key figures from the past. There's an excerpt if you want to read more. If you go to unbound.com/books/MacGaming, you can get a digital copy for $15. But these are pledges because they haven't yet, you know, they're raising money. The hardcover will be $40. And, of course, there's additional benefits going on. This is a crowd-funded book, and he's close but not there yet, Richard Moss. I just want to read the book, so I'm going to kick in. The untold story of a creative, innovative, fiercely independent gaming scene that was serially ignored by the outside world. The secret history of Mac gaming. What fun, huh?
I know some folks who actually tried to bring Crystal Quest back. They tried to crowdfund it, but it didn't make it.
Don't be alarmed, Adam, but the Penguin's getting bigger and you're getting smaller.
Okay, let's see.
And just don't worry. It's going to be okay. Adam, always a pleasure. Tidbits.com, at Adam Egst on Twitter. Love having you. Thanks for joining us today. We appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, Leo. It's always a fun.
Thanks so much, too, to Daniel Jalkut. We'll see you in another 8 years. No, we're not going to make it that long this time. I don't know how Andy, back me up. I say this all the time. We should get Daniel on.
We should get Daniel on.
Yeah. So finally we did, and I apologize. We'll get
I got your back on this. I vote more Daniel is very much more okay and positive in my book.
Yeah, we love it. Red-sweater.com, Red Sweater Software. Another one. You know, they should write a book about, early Mac shareware developers, because it was just such a wonderful, vibrant scene before that GD Mac App Store came along.
Hey, you know, I wanted to add one more thing about sure. that game, that classic games on the Mac thing. Something I noticed a few months ago was that one of the names listed there was Glider.
Yeah.
You know, John Calhoun.
Love John Calhoun's
so,
Glider.
Yeah. For anybody who's technically ambitious with source code, you should know that Glider's source code is completely available on GitHub.
Oh my God.
Go searching for that. And I poked around at it, and it's not trivial to get building or anything because it's all old.
Is it Pascal? What's it written in?
Yeah, I think it was C, but it's all old Carbon C stuff. So you kind of have to, this is going to be somebody's fantasy project to pursue, but it's kind of cool even just to look at it and be able to download and see, how this classic Mac game was organized in source code. So
I guess it's
fun.
I guess it's from John, right? But his handle is Soft Dorothy.
Yeah, I think that's him.
Yeah,
Look, he's got all kinds of stuff up there.
Wow.
But you see that MCP, for instance, file extension? That's like a MetroWorks interface.
MetroWorks. That was a great C compiler.
Yes,
boy, absolutely. I loved MetroWorks.
Kept the Mac alive, I'd say, for
yeah. Oh, man, I wrote so much stuff in that. I love it. It was fast, had a great IDE. Ah, oh, man, there's a blast. I forgot about MetroWorks.
Yep.
I loved that. Andy Iannocco, Chicago Sun-Times, always a tip of the hat, a doff of the cap to you, and thank you for being here. We'll see you next week, I hope.
Always. Thank you very much.
I hope we'll see all of you next week. We do Mac Break Weekly every Tuesday, 11 a.m. Pacific, 2 p.m. Eastern Time, 1800 UTC. You can join us live. Join us in the chat room. Watch as we make the sausage. We slip it into the casing, tie it up, throw it at you. Oh, if you just want to get the end result, though, you can also get that at twit.tv/MPW. Pre-cooked for your pleasure. Or wherever you get podcasts. Just, iTunes is fine, but of course there's a podcast app on iOS, and there are other great third-party podcast apps. There's even Twit apps on every single platform, so you could just pick the app of your choice, subscribe, because we don't want you to miss an episode. Thanks for being here. We'll see you next time. Now get back to work! It's break time. It's over.